WRAF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Hi, Jolene.
Hi, Peter.
Yeah, a couple of actually happy occasions, a couple Sundays running. We have the Wings over the Sharks.
We now do. 4-3, big game.
Yeah. And now each game is going to be a big game because the Sharks need one more.
Yeah, but we're going to be on, we sound like such sports talk people here.
Yeah.
We're going to be on home ice coming up in the next game, Peter.
That's good. And also the other nice occasion is that it's Mother's Day. So we send a big happy Mother's Day out to all the mothers and all the mother... Never mind.
Mother truckers.
Mother truckers, yeah. Well, what do you think is the best country in the world? I know you know the answer. Yeah, the best place in the world to be a mom. Well, it's not the United States.
Oh, not number one.
Not number two. Not number three. No. Well, it's going to take too long. The best place in the world to be a mom is Norway. And that's according to the Save the Children's 12th Annual Mothers Index. And they, what they do is they figure out where maternal and child mortality rates are low, women's life expectancy and years in school are high, and the average maternity leave is about 1 year.
Now, isn't that amazing?
What's the what's the maternity leave here in the United States?
You know there is one, but it's
they don't get
not
paid
very long. Yeah,
they,
no, I think
no,
they
no,
do.
No, no, no,
really?
No, by
Come
law,
on.
By law in these Scandinavian countries, women get a year off, and I forgot what the deal is in Canada.
And husbands get like three months over there,
right? Right.
And Norway's cool because, well,
come on,
I'm Norwegian.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Well, Iceland and Australia join Norway at the top of the Save the Children's 12th Annual Mothers Index. What about the U.S.?
Let's see. Where are we? Wait. Nope. Not there. Keep going. Keep going down. Keep going. Keep going. Oh! 31st.
Wow.
Shameful.
Okay, let's do our chant. USA. USA. Number 31. Number 31. You know, it's nice to joke about it, but it's actually a disgrace.
It is.
It really is a disgrace. I mean, it's a disgrace that there is any poverty in the world at all, because it doesn't have to be. It's all about the distribution of income. And we have a country like ours that is, at least now, the wealthiest, maybe not for long, and I'll talk about that a little later, wealthiest country in the world, where, in other words, where the most wealth resides. So we would think that, well, you know, everybody's kind of doing okay with that. You know, these conservatives are always saying the poor live better here than...
That is such crap.
It is.
You know?
So what we wind up with, there are 30 other countries that where the maternal and child mortality rates are lower, where a woman's life expectancy is higher, the years in school are higher, and the average maternity leave, which we don't even have. All right? So... Mother's Day, though, has a very interesting origin. It's just kind of, it was the hallmarkization, would you call it? That's just sort of another one of these hallmark.
Yeah, commercial. You know,
but, I mean, I really think it is.
Garden flowers.
Yeah.
This is one. Women deserve it. These mothers deserve it.
But
day,
on the other hand, it does bring people in touch with their mom, and people take mom out to breakfast.
I sent
and,
my mom flowers. I called her today.
Yeah. And it is a day for special appreciation. But it has kind of radical origins, and it always kills me that that so many of the
organized kind of holidays, most around religion.
Well, but a lot of them have very radical roots.
Most of them have pagan roots.
Well, you're right. Here's what I'm thinking.
Okay.
You're right.
Yeah.
Most of the religious holidays have pagan roots for sure. I was thinking of like the Pledge of Allegiance
that was
written by a socialist.
Yeah, yeah.
What else do we have? America the Beautiful that was written by a lesbian.
Yes.
This Land is Your Land, written by a communist. Or at least, I don't know.
You know, I would have to venture to say about 99% of the population doesn't even know that.
No.
And they listen to Night Call.
And this, to the right wing, I don't think anybody else cares about this, but a lot to the right wing, that saying at the base of the Statue of Liberty, that was written by a Jewish poet.
Oh, my.
You know, most ordinary people wouldn't care, but the far right wing, you know.
So all of this diversity for all of those years, and still we are stuck in this, I don't know.
But in any event,
of hate.
The person who formulated the first Mother's Day was Julia Ward Howe. And she had just seen the extraordinary carnage of the American Civil War. Nothing had ever compared to that before. Those traitors to the United States of Southern states who precipitated this war, who actually fired the first shot on the Union troops, and who made people like Benedict Arnold seem almost like patriots by comparison, were responsible for ultimately for 650,000 deaths. And more people died in the Civil War because of the desire of these slave states to be able to have their state right to enslave other human beings. And wound up 650,000 people, which was more than the total combined of the whole rest of U.S. wars, including World War II, which was about 400,000 or 450,000 deaths.
That's a good trivia question there, sadly enough.
But there, Julia Ward Howe wrote this very, very poignant and very radical, given what we've seen, what she saw in her life and what we've seen since, calling for peace.
1870.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think she was listened to, and the rest, sadly, is history.
But and now it says, of course, in this, there's an article, it says, now it's a hymn to flowers. Now, Mother's Day is a hymn to flowers and chocolate and other trinkets of capitalism to the tune of $14 billion.
Wow.
Yeah. So here I'm going to read the poem, and it includes a lot of kind of anti-war sentiment. Very nice. Here we go.
Could I just stop you one sec, though, because I meant to do this in my introduction.
Yeah.
Two things.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't do our basic stuff.
Okay.
One thing. So my apologies. Moms, this is coming. The Mother's Day Proclamation from 1870.
We must read it.
Yeah. You're listening to Night Call with me, Peter Werby, and Jelaine Jordan. Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And if you'd like to email us if you're bashful or if the lines are filled, which they are not right now. You can email us at calltalkyes. That's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. My website, peterwerby.com, is still screwed up. Don't start me.
I'm not saying anything.
Okay. But you can go to our Facebook, which
I already
is,
made you feel bad about it the other day.
Which is facebook.com/nightcall. Yeah, here's the deal, folks. You can go to this Facebook page, though. You can go to the Facebook page even if you don't, you're not, what would you say, belong to it?
Yeah,
what's the word?
If you're not registered.
If you're not registered, which I'm not, but Nightcall has it. So, you know how you people take, like tons of photos. So Jelaine gets this photo of me and her. I look terrible. She looks so hot. And so she puts that one up there.
Peter, you're too kind.
Yeah.
I know. Well, your eyes are kind of closed, but
yeah.
I put it up anyway. And you sure didn't give me a hard time. So everyone go look because it's funny.
We have podcasts available at noon on Mondays. Thanks to Athena and Sarah.
Yes, busy working in the other room.
Yeah, we'll get your calls at 313-298-WRIF. Yeah, there was something that happened last Sunday. What was that? Yeah,
that little announcement.
Yeah, which the first almost hour of our show was taken up with the live coverage from NBC of the killing of Osama bin Laden, which mm-hmm. we will talk about. But anyway, we're talking about today, we're saluting the moms. We'll get to that in a minute. We're saluting the moms, and this is the first proclamation for Mother's Day, written by Julia Ward Howe in 1870.
Okay.
Go ahead, Jelaine.
Arise then, women of this day. Arise, all women who have hearts, whether our baptism be of water or of tears. Say firmly, we will not have great questions decided by irrelevant agencies. Our husbands will not come to us reeking with carnage for caresses and applause. Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience. We, the women of our country, one country, will be too tender of those of another country to allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs. From the bosom of the devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, disarm, disarm. The sword of murder is not the balance of justice. Blood does not wipe out dishonor, nor violence indicate possession. As men have often forsaken the plow and the anvil at the summons of war, let women now leave all that may be left of home for a great and earnest day of counsel. Let them meet first as women to bewail and commemorate the dead. Let them solemnly take counsel with each other as to the means whereby the great human family can live in peace, each bearing after his own time the sacred impress, not of Caesar, but of God. In the name of womanhood and humanity, I earnestly ask that a General Congress of Women without limit of nationality may be appointed and held at some place deemed most convenient, and at the earliest period consistent with its objects to promote the alliance of the different nationalities, the amicable settlement of international questions, the great and general interests of peace.
And that's the origins of Mother's Day, 1870, written by Julia Ward Howe. Of course, no one listened.
Know that.
No one listened to them at all.
Right, and go figure.
And the carnage that followed, we all know about. And of course, we all say, no matter what side we're on, it is them. It is they who want war and not peace, right?
Yeah.
In any event, last Sunday, the first almost hour of this show was preempted by the NBC coverage and the speech of President Barack Obama about the killing of Osama bin Laden. And almost every, other than the fact that Osama bin Laden is dead, although there's people, let's not even go there. The vast majority of people know,
the message, they get it.
Most of what we learned wasn't so. There wasn't a 40-minute firefight. Osama bin Laden wasn't hiding behind his wife's skirt.
Right.
He wasn't armed. I can't even remember. His wife wasn't killed.
Right.
There were
four other people killed, men killed, but not one of them was one of his wives. There were three there with him.
This was a courageous raid by a special forces unit, the Navy SEALs, who I think isn't already obvious will come out. Essentially, this was an assassination squad that decided to take out Osama bin Laden and took extraordinary risks and brought great joy to hundreds of millions of people, maybe more, billions of people around the world.
Can you imagine the goosebumps or the butterflies in your stomach going into something like that? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, well,
I can't imagine.
These guys are well-trained. Now, there are some people have objected to what they call extrajudicial killing. In other words, it essentially is illegal under international law. You just can't go into other people's country and kill people. Israelis do it a lot. I don't know. I'm trying to think whether other countries do. But
as far as government organizations.
And there has been some objection on the left that he should have been captured and put on trial. I got to tell you, I'm happy that it ended like this. Because we want to take this chess piece off the board. We want to get this all out of our lives. And I don't know what this is necessarily going to end. We'll see as time goes on.
I think it's just a restructuring, really. But
the idea.
It's a big sign that we will find you eventually.
The idea, though, that there would have been first off, the capture of Osama bin Laden. Having been, bring him to the United States, all of what, can you imagine what that would have precipitated in the world? And then a trial where, among other things, he would have been given the right to speak. We're lucky it ended in this way. There's enough egregious examples of the United States projecting its military power way beyond legality and truth and honesty, like the war in Iraq, that centering on taking out this very, very awful person. Is not an issue with me. I don't know how the rest of you feel. You can give us a call, 313-298-WRIF, and just... Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say there may be an issue with the phones. Some people keep getting hung up on. I don't know. Because I just got an email from the other studio.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
So keep trying, and we'll see what it is.
Yeah. Let me see if I can even get our my little screen-a-roo up here. Huh. Well, that's not happening. Okay. Got to find some other way to do this. I forgot. Oh yeah. I do remember.
Okay.
But anyway. We got one person on hold, so somebody must have been able to get through, right?
Why don't we try taking a phone call?
Well,
I
don't want to do that.
You don't? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. All right. Let's see if this brings us. It's bringing me a dark screen.
That's not good.
Yeah. All right. 313-298-WRIF. Give it a try. In fact, let's see. Phone connection is messing up.
Okay.
All right.
Peter, you keep talking. I'm going to work on some things.
All right. Okay. Here's a couple of things that are going on. And you got to remember, the whole situation that we find ourselves in now could have been altered a long time ago. This is, I think, a very, very important article by Gareth Porter. If you've listened, remember some of the guests I've had in the past following Night Call, the interviews I do, you may remember Gareth Porter. He's an investigative historian and journalist specializing in U.S. national security policy. Here's what he writes at commondreams.org. You do read commondreams.org every day, don't you? Well, you think you'd get a good idea at least where a lot of my thinking is coming from. It's called U.S. Refusal of 2001 Taliban Offer Gave Bin Laden a Free Pass. Now, wait a minute. What's this all about, huh? Here's what it says. When George W. Bush rejected a Taliban offer to have Osama bin Laden tried by a moderate group of Islamic states in mid-October 2001, he gave up the only opportunity the United States would have to end bin Laden's terrorist career for the next 9 years. So George W. Bush at that time was saying, we're not negotiating. We want you, the Taliban, to give up Osama bin Laden. I don't even know if they could have delivered him, actually, but that wasn't the issue. But this was an extraordinarily hardened position, which sounded good, but it has led us to what we've experienced for the last 10 years. In fact, the September 11th event itself was precipitated by the Bush administration not giving attention to what was in the works. I hope you know by now that George W. Bush at his ranch in Texas, where he used to clear brush all the time, that he was given a memo that said Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S. And what did George W. Bush did? He looked at the man who gave it to him and said, well, you've covered your ass. That was it. That was the Bush response. So the inattentiveness of George Bush itself, the very fact that that 9/11 happened on Bush's doorstep or during his administration, I think at a minimum, well, I don't know why I'm temporizing here, that he bears extraordinary responsibility for that. I mean, ultimately, of course, it's Osama bin Laden. It's these right-wing religionists who think that they can rationalize killing civilians because you almost could fill in the blanks. Whoever kills civilians always has some rationalization. The United States and its policies has killed millions of civilians since World War II. I mean, we never set out to do it. Well, maybe in some cases, yeah, like the bombings of Germany and Japan. But since then, it's just been collateral damage. So there was a million civilians that were collateral damage during the Korean War. And there was, they don't even know, 2-3 million civilians as collateral damage during the Vietnam War and on and on. And we have good reasons, or the government, I don't even want to say we, the government always had good reason why. We didn't intend to kill a few million Indochinese civilians. We were carrying out a particular policy. But, well, it all winds up. It doesn't matter whether you're doing it for good reasons, for our country, or for, one's religion or whatever. The civilians are just dead, right? Everybody's got a reason why they're doing it. Well, in any event, here's what happened. The Al-Qaeda leader was able to escape into Pakistan a few weeks after October 2001 because the Bush administration had no military plan to capture him. Now, why didn't they? I mean, this happened. Well, the answer, and I have to go through a page or two in this, because Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of War, were determined not to allow a focus on bin Laden to interfere with their plan for a U.S. invasion of Iraq to overthrow the Saddam Hussein regime. So this, talk about malign plans. Talk about not focusing on the real problems. I mean, this doesn't get any worse than that. And I just want to play you something. Then, of course, we had the situation with the hunt for Osama bin Laden. Remember, Bush was saying, we're going to bring him in dead or alive.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do I start this thing? Let's just do it. I know what I have to do. Sorry. I've just figured this out. Ooh, I don't have it up here. Oh, well. I'm going to have to do that. But it was George Bush saying, I don't even think about him. I don't know, you know.
He said that in one of his most recent interviews, right?
Well, initially he said that. Well, they literally almost disbanded the group that was trying to track down Osama bin Laden. And then it was reconstituted in 2005. And finally, because of years of careful investigative work and interrogations and what have you, they finally pieced it all together. Didn't come as a result of torture.
That's right. And I was listening to someone from the armed forces today, someone high up. It was radio, so I didn't really know who it was, but. And he was saying that very same thing. It was all these different pieces of intelligence that came together. It wasn't one piece of intelligence. He would not answer the question straight out, was this a result of waterboarding? Was this a direct result of torture measures? And he said this wasn't a result of one, you know, so he's kind of vague about it.
Well, the people that were responsible for turning the United States into a torture state, these Republicans in the Bush administration. I mean, the United States puts out a State Department report every year where it criticizes countries that employ torture and critically. And yet here was a situation with Abu Ghraib, with Bagram Air Force Base, with Guantanamo, with, all of this, that the United States, because of George W. Bush, qualifies exactly as that, as a torture state. And the other thing you think about, I mean, you think about people, whether they were, you know, mistakenly being tortured or whether they, in fact, were pretty horrible people that they were trying to torture information out of, whatever. The United States then had to turn our citizens, the Bush regime had to take our citizens and turn them into torturers. They tortured, these were people that, I can't imagine that there was every single person agreed to it. In fact, I don't know if I still have that. Yeah, there's an article that was in April 27th called Honoring Those Who Said No. In January 2004, specialist Joseph M. Darby, 24-year-old reservist in Iraq, discovered a set of photographs showing other members of his country, of his company, torturing prisoners at the Abu Ghraib prison. And then he was the one that that blew the whistle on all this. But then this article goes on. It says, in Afghanistan, soldiers and contractors recoiled at interrogation techniques they witnessed. After seeing a prisoner beaten by a mysterious special forces team, one interpreter filed an official complaint. I was very upset that such a thing could happen. I take my responsibilities as an interrogator and as a human being very seriously. When you torture people, you have diminished, if not eliminated, your humanness. Even if
your humanity, yeah.
Your humanity. Even if you're facing someone who has committed some inhuman act.
Well, and these.
Well, it doesn't even work.
Guys, I'm going to go out on a limb and say, think that it doesn't, but it does.
Yeah. Right. Here, maybe, let me see if we can, this will come up and this will be the Bush. No? What am I doing?
And he's a person who's now been marginalized. So I don't know where he is. Nor, I just don't spend that much time on him.
Nice.
To be honest with you.
Didn't spend much time on him?
Yeah, that's George W. Bush. I didn't spend much time
more.
On him. Yeah, yeah. So this this article from the Times, New York Times, Bin Laden raid revives debate on value of torture. It really, only among these Republicans, politicians, these civilians. For instance, where is this little darling? If I have her here, like Dick Cheney's daughter. What's her name?
Mary.
Mary. Yeah. Liz. Liz, rather.
Okay.
Liz Cheney, daughter of the former vice president, quickly issued a statement declaring that she was, quote, grateful to men and women of America's intelligence services who, through their interrogation of high-value detainees, developed the information that apparently led us to bin Laden. She doesn't, God, I can
I
just
know.
Swear.
She,
what
know.
Does she know?
I know, seriously.
Yeah.
Zip it.
Yeah. Torture apologists, according to the Huffington Post, Dan Frumkin's article, are reaching precisely the wrong conclusion from the back story of the hunt for Osama bin Laden, say experienced interrogators and intelligence professionals. Defenders of the Bush administration's interrogation policies have claimed vindication from reports that bin Laden was tracked down in small part due to information received from brutalized detainees some 6 to 8 years ago. I like the way, too, they call it enhanced interrogation.
Right, they make it sound like it's a, like it's HDTV or something.
Yeah, right. Here at the, I've got so many stories on this. The New York Times, interviewing an array of intelligence sources, reported that, quote, a closer look at prisoner interrogation suggests that the harsh techniques played a small role at most in identifying bin Laden's trusted courier and exposing his hideout. Most importantly, the Times noted that two prisoners who underwent some of the harshest treatment, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was waterboarded 183 times, repeatedly misled their interrogators about the courier's identity. So, in fact, it sent them off in
the wrong direction.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and there's this is an Air Force interrogator who goes by the pseudonym Matthew Alexander and located Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. He says, this is the American interrogator, I think that without a doubt, torture and enhanced interrogation techniques slowed down the hunt for bin Laden. So who are you going to believe? People like Karl Rove and
Liz Cheney
and
Sean Hannity.
What's that guy that all of a sudden has gone to zero? He's leaving Fox News. Glenn Beck.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah,
guys like
he's
that.
He's gearing up for his next insane assault.
The two. There's been a lot of rumors around this, you know, and the two I like. One, this is from this stuff is such lunatics. I mean, there's, you know, people like this Alex Jones. This guy is so unreliable. But red alert, government had Osama bin Laden frozen for years. And they say they got all this stuff saying he died in 2005 and that the Democrats were fearful that, some of them, they say different things. Some of them say he died even earlier than that because one of the fears was that if it looked like the race was going to be close in 2004, which it was. In fact, Bush stole us, you know, two elections running, and it was so close that they had to steal the election in Ohio. Instead, they had, like they had done in Florida 4 years before. And so that the Democrats were afraid that on the day before the election, Bush was going to announce that they had just killed Osama bin Laden. So that's what Alex Jones says, that the government has had bin Laden frozen for years, and they just trotted him out right now. The other thing was, when bin Laden was captured, in his clothing, he had they had money sewn into his clothing.
What?
Yeah, he did.
Oh, this is for real?
Yeah, and also a series of phone numbers, and one of them was the private line of George W. Bush.
No.
Well, that's what I'm not saying that happened. So our phone's working. Are you just are you not calling us?
For the payphone? Yeah, I think we need to go to break and we need to figure out this phone issue, Peter.
All right, one other thing. Support for President Obama rose sharply after the killing of Osama bin Laden, with a majority now approving of his overall performance as well as his handling of foreign policy, the war in Afghanistan, the threat of terrorism, a cure for cancer. I mean, this is. He did what a big country with enormous resources and the will to project power would do. Okay, and good. And as I said, Osama bin Laden swept off the chessboard. Excellent. Let's get him out of our lives. I can't believe that there's still more and more going on. What about the dog that may have been there and all that? It's only one thing I care about, that this man is out of our lives.
Well, and they were able to sweep up a bunch of things in the room where he was, and in that compound information, there are some computers.
Remember, too, it was this luxury mansion. They said he was living in luxury.
Right, not
just
so much.
Yeah, yeah. But here, let me see if I'm going to just play this. Bush, here's what Bush said about him. This does not work.
Turn it, pot it up?
Oh, no, that's not it. It just didn't go. Huh? Go, go, go.
Oh, it's not our night. Technology there.
One person. And he's a person who's now been marginalized. So I don't know where he is. Nor, you know, I just don't spend that much time on him, really, to be honest with you.
Yeah,
didn't
right.
spend much time on him?
That's George Bush.
Blowhole.
Let's see. The euphoria around the killing of Osama bin Laden was tempered by a sense of foreboding. More than 6 in 10 Americans said that killing bin Laden was likely to increase the threat of terrorism against the United States in the short term. A large majority also said that the al-Qaeda's leader's death did not make them feel any safer. Doesn't make me feel. Just 16% of people said that they felt safer. How about you?
Well, it looks like the phones are good. So okay. I think people, we deterred them by saying they were broken. So call 313-298-9743.
And one final thing. The U.S. military's use of Geronimo as a code name for Osama bin Laden tarnished the achievement of the raid by insulting an American ethnic group. Native American tribal leaders and advocates told Congress on Thursday. It was kind of weird.
Yeah, Michael wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com and said that when he thinks of bin Laden's death, he can only picture... he said that image just feels so wrong on so many levels, what he said, yeah.
Okay. And Geronimo, of course, was this 19th century warrior chieftain who evaded thousands of Mexican and U.S. soldiers. And, of course, they were trying to drive him out of his own land.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not quite the same thing. So the comparison is absolutely horrible. All right, we're going to take a break. Give us a call, 313-298-WRIF. Wait a minute. Don't we pay a guy to do this?
Say it, man.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
We're twins. We each have the same car, and we both insured our cars with Esurance because of all their great discounts. But we're not identical twins. I got all my Esurance discounts on my laptop from their website. I got all mine over the phone from a real live human. But we both love discounts and lumberjacks.
To get car insurance discounts you can love, get a quote today at esurance.com or 1-800-ESURANCE. Esurance, technology when you want it, people when you don't.
Not available in all states. Some restrictions apply. Discounts may vary by state. See site for details.
Does your furnace need repair? Just go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Is your roof leaking? Or are you ready to replace your windows? Log on to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Big or small, no matter what your home improvement need, now it's easy to find the right home pro at fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic is a free online source of licensed and insured contractors in hundreds of home improvement categories. You can have instant access to roofers, plumbers, maids, handymen, chimney sweeps, remodelers, and many other professionals. Visit fixitfast.servicemagic.com and find the right home pro for your project. It's easy and it's free, and it's the source to find neighbor-recommended contractors in your area. Now you can hire a pre-screened home pro with confidence. Go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. It's quick, it's free, and there's no obligation. Go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. That's fixitfast.servicemagic.com.
Hello?
Hi, I'm calling about the two-bedroom apartment you advertised. Is it still available?
Sure.
Great.
Unless you're black or Latino or disabled.
Housing discrimination is rarely this obvious, but it's just as real and just as illegal. So if you hear things like,
I can't assign you a handicapped parking space.
That could be housing discrimination. But the only way to stop it is to report it so we can investigate it. Visit hud.gov/fairhousing or call HUD's housing discrimination hotline at 1-800-669-9777. A message from HUD in partnership with the National Fair Housing Alliance.
Who's watching your home when you're not there? It could be a burglar. Burglars prefer to break in when they think no one is home and no one will stop them. Don't be an easy target for intruders. Protect your home with a free security system monitored by ADT, the leader in home security. Pick up your phone now and get free hardware, free medical and fire alerts, and free activation. It's an $850 value. Just call Protect Your Home, your authorized ADT dealer, at 1-877-653-8844. you'll get 24-hour protection, and there's no cost for parts or activation. Call now about a free security system monitored by ADT. Call 1-877-653-8844. $99 installation charge, 36-month monitoring agreement at $35.99 per month. Call for terms and conditions to this offer and protect your home license numbers. Call now, 1-877-653-8844. That's 1-877-653-8844.
Is it time for a new roof? Call Sears Roofing. You can save $500 if you call right now. Just call 1-877-938-1414. Hurry, offer ends soon. Not available in all states. Installation provided by Sears Authorized Licensed Contractors. License information available upon request. Get your roofing job done right. Call Sears Roofing now. You can save $500. Call now. 1-877-938-1414. Sears.
If you have a job instead of a career, will you be satisfied tomorrow? But if you develop knowledge and skills, who knows how far you can go? If you're interested in electronics technology, drafting and design, or information technology, call ITT Technical Institute. Classes meet just a few times a week, and financial aid is available to those who qualify. Call ITT Tech now for more information. 800-741-5123. 800-741-5123. Homeowners, the mortgage market is starting to move, but the good news is rates are still incredibly low. Don't miss this opportunity to refinance your mortgage. Call Quicken Loans at 888-249-1425. Quicken Loans is America's home loan experts, closing 1 million home loans over 25 years. And recently, J.D. Power & Associates ranked Quicken Loans highest in customer satisfaction in primary mortgage origination. Find out how quick and easy it is to refinance with Quicken Loans. Call right now for a free rate quote and see how much Quicken Loans can lower your monthly payment. Call 888-249-1425. That's 888-249-1425. For J.D. Power & Associates award information, visit jdpower.com. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. Nationwide mortgage licensing system number 3030. That's Quicken Loans. 888-249-1425. 888-249-1425.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. I was just looking at the wrong screen because all our lines are filled. I'm thinking, we're talking about the killing of Osama bin Laden, the assassination of him, the extrajudiciary. It was extrajudicial. I can't even say it.
Extrajudiciary.
I can't say it. Well, I said it before. The extrajudiciary killing of the man. And I said, I was glad. Wipe him off the board. Let's move on. All right? And, this just keeps playing big in the news. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Bill in KPAC. Hi, Bill. You're on the air. Welcome. Bill. Oh.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. It's not doing it. Look at that.
Really?
Yeah. That's not. So something is amiss here still. Can you put them on? Can you, if you do that?
No.
I can.
You need to hit it on the board. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to have to. All right.
There
hey, Bill. Bill, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello?
Hey, Bill, yeah. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going good. What's up?
Not much. You're talking about Osama, right?
Yeah.
They went in. What I heard was they went in and he was unarmed and they blew his head off, right?
Yeah. I think that was their intent, don't you?
Well, yeah, but, I mean, they shot his wife in the leg. Why couldn't they have shot him in the leg and then brought him to trial?
Well, what do you think about what I said, Bill, that to have brought him here and to, first off, I think that would have unleashed a wave of attacks on the United States, United States assets. In the WikiLeaks, which are all these cables, they have threatened a nuclear device against the United States. I don't know whether they have it or not. I mean, this may have pissed them off pretty badly as well, you know, taking out their main man.
And throwing him in the sea, right?
And then to have a trial, which is what under international law should have occurred, then allow him to speak, allow defense attorneys. I don't know. Don't you think it would be a mess?
It probably would have been, but I don't think it would have caused any more turmoil than what, you know, what's going on now. I mean, I'm sure they're plotting something.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing is that, think about these what, six guys? Is it really six guys who went in there and did this? Just
I don't know. I think it was much more than that.
Okay, anyway, these guys going
20.
Okay, so let's say whatever. It's a pretty volatile situation to be in, and it's pretty quick moving, I would imagine. So I think maybe choosing the leg to make it prettier and everything like that might be a little bit unreasonable.
I think they were supposed to take him out. I mean, for one thing, there is that old saying, a dead man tell no tales. And Osama bin Laden could tell a lot of tales. For one thing, I mean, well, here, Bill, what we're not talking about, there's two aspects of it. One, this guy has a lot of information. I don't know if he'd be willing to give any of it up. But the other thing is, there's all this talk about how Osama bin Laden goes back to the CIA-sponsored Mujahideen in Afghanistan 20 years ago, yep, and more, and all of that. And he would have been with us for years more. But, I mean, I know what you're saying. That some people say that there should have been a trial, but we'll see. Thank you. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Abby in Southfield. Hi, Abby. You're on the air. Wait a minute. I forgot. I can't do that.
We're over here.
This is crazy.
Yeah.
Hi, Abby. You're on the air.
Hello?
Abby. Yeah, hi, Abby. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. Hi. It was a little staticky there.
Okay. We're all
I met you two at the rally on Friday.
Oh, yes, we did. Yeah. Remember, we saw you in the parking
lot. A lot of people showed up. It was pretty great.
Thanks for coming out.
Oh, yeah. But I just wanted to make sure that people also know that we should keep that recall effort alive.
Recall Rick Snyder, the nerd.
I was thinking in terms of
the governor of Michigan. Yeah.
Yes. And I don't know if you knew that she was there, but Adrienne was there. From she was featured in Michael Moore's movie in Sicko.
Oh.
I don't know if you have ever met Adrienne, but she'll come to a couple of the demonstrations on 9 in Woodward. I've met her in the past.
Let me just tell Abby what we're talking about. Oh. There was a demonstration called by Jobs with Justice, the Southeast Michigan branch, to defend the teachers and public employees. Angelina and I and some of the listeners showed up as well.
Like
but
Abby.
I'll tell you, Abby, I was disappointed.
Oh, were you?
Yeah, I thought there was going to be a lot more people.
It rained.
It was a terrible rainstorm. But what do you know, hey, in Madison, they turned out 100,000 people in the middle of blizzards. Come on, people, our jobs are at stake.
Yeah, it's summertime's coming up, and I think we need to all get to Lansing when they call us to get up there in Benton Harbor and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, I wanted to make a quick comment before I left, but on the, interrogation, interrogating.
Sure.
I remember my dad telling me before he passed, he was in World War II, and he always used to say there was some investigative or intelligence officer that was very famous for, like, giving prisoners, like Nazi prisoners, German soldiers, liquor or sodium pentothal, I forget what it was, and then he played games, card games with them. And while he was doing that,
I bet he won.
Right.
He got him drunk, so the
truth. Oh, no, wait. Abby's got a good point. Then that's what all these interrogators say, that why torture doesn't work.
Yeah, you know, like when you get drunk and you need to tell someone, I love you. Oh, my God, I love you.
All right, Abby, thank you very much, and it was good to see you and others
at
the rally. And I just figured out one more little adjustment here, and I think that I should. Oh, my God, what did I just do?
Peter.
All right, we're going to see if this now works. Here is John in Ypsilanti.
Yay!
It works. Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'd like to first off thank our boys in our Navy, especially the SEALs, for the great job they did tracking down and getting a handle on Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, they found him.
Pretty impressive.
Without a doubt, you have to know those guys to understand aggressive.
I should say so.
Yeah, right?
Holy cow.
A handful takes out a compound or his luxury house or whatever it was.
Well, it didn't turn out to be
a luxury.
It turned out to be a pretty poor excuse for
where the money was. Peter was in the over the $1 million they spent building the reinforcements.
Right, Right. God, it looked like a slum.
Right. So we didn't have to bomb it. We just had to go in with M-16.
Right.
Yeah. Much better deal.
Yeah.
Millions of dollars on bombs.
what
are we going to do? What are we going to do about the Pakistanis who basically hit them?
You mean the Pakistanis who we're giving billions of dollars to of our tax money?
Yeah, $1.5 billion a year.
I think is the number, right?
Yeah. Let me ask you this, John. If we took a vote among the American people and said, how many of us want to give billions of dollars to Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Jordan, Egypt, do you think very many people would vote to give our money away to them?
No, I do not think so.
I don't think so either.
I don't care how liberal you are. I got to believe you'd take a pass on that one.
I'll take a big pass on that.
Well, I actually think the more liberal you are, the less you want that.
Well, you know what? In this case, I don't think it even matters. I don't think that there is, you know, I don't think there's anybody of any persuasion that wants to keep giving away billions of dollars.
Except for the industries that stand to
benefit. When we're losing teachers and firefighters, we're closing libraries and all that because we don't have enough money. All right, John, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. In fact, that would, where did that go? I don't know. Got too much stuff here. That they're that in New York City they're talking about laying off altogether about 7,000 teachers.
Yeah,
because they they got to save some money. I don't understand it. They got this billionaire as a mayor, Michael Bloomberg. He's the 10th richest man in America, and they want to save like $400 million by laying off all these teachers. Why doesn't he write a check?
He won't. He's greedy.
Yeah, I mean,
rich
I don't understand greedy if you got billions. Maybe you get greedy if you got hundreds of thousands. You know, I want more. I want to buy this. I want to buy that. I mean, he has everything. Do you realize that he could write a check for $400 million and still be so wealthy he wouldn't even be able to count it?
Yeah, right.
I don't get it. All right, let's move onward to TJ in Novi. TJ, hi. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You are on the air. Hi. TJ.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
I think that, you know how they buried him at sea?
Yeah.
I think that really wasn't, like, because they said they did it to stop the religious backlash sort of thing. I think they should have kept him for a while and then let the public know that he was truly, like, dead.
Oh, he's talking about the burying at sea, Peter.
Oh, the burying at sea, yeah. I just heard some right-wingers saying they got to wrap him in bacon and threw him into
Yeah.
Let's get these people even more pissed off at us.
Don't they get it? Don't they get this is dealing with a great deal of anger issues already?
Yeah. All right, TJ, thank you.
Thanks, TJ.
On the other hand, I don't think much of the kind of anger projected by these right-wing freaks in the media. But the anger and the very, I hate to say it, because we don't sometimes like to see ourselves as that, as human beings, the human desire for revenge goes pretty deep.
Sure.
And, I mean, it was kind of weird. These college kids were probably, 9 years old when this happened, celebrating. And, one of these colleges where after a football game, they jump in this lake. I think it was either Minnesota or Wisconsin.
Or like Lake Minnetonka?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. They were doing that. But the joy that came out of the knowledge that this man had just been splattered after the heinous act that he had engendered, I think runs pretty deep in human emotions.
Yeah, multiple acts. That wasn't the only one.
Yeah, no, that's right.
And, here's the other argument that I'll throw out, and it's not mine. I'm just quoting what other people were saying. Of course, the almighty Facebook, and talk about information coming out at you. Some people are saying, I will never celebrate the killing of anyone, no matter who it is. I saw that some brave people. I thought it was brave of them because that's very, very unpopular.
Someone said that to me, and they said it's against the ethics of any organized philosophy from religion to
Buddhism,
humanism, and all of that. On the other hand, I said to them, well, what if somebody would have assassinated Mussolini or Hitler or Stalin?
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of said, well,
you know, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. So one, I think also a pretty profound trend has been that Osama bin Laden's day has probably passed in any event. And it doesn't mean that we're going to stop these individuals or maybe even still organized from taking out their rage or their politics that they think is legitimized by what they see the United States or the Western countries doing by killing civilians that don't have anything to do with it.
The long history of that, Peter.
Yeah. But now what's really created the change are popular democratic movements. I mean, the what's happened in Tunisia, what happened in Egypt, and what is attempting to happen in Syria. Why are we giving Muammar Gaddafi such a hard time? I mean, on one hand, you'd almost say well-deserved, when that Bashar Assad in Syria has been killing hundreds and hundreds of people in the most horrid manner imaginable.
You know, it's kind of like a fad wars. You know what I mean? It's like for people, it has to be a little more sexy, a little more popular in the news for people to actually pay attention. Do people even know about Syria?
I don't know. Let's go to Dustin in Shelby Township. Dustin, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
We're good.
I just wanted to, I was going to talk a second about the enhanced interrogation tactics.
The torture,
exactly. It clearly was very ineffective. It took us a decade to find the guy. So, like, any arguments anybody has about how effective any of that is, it took a decade of torturing people to finally find him. And I don't think there are any other arguments are justified with how long it took us to actually locate him.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, I don't usually use this cliche, but it is, in a way, sort of the bottom line. If it worked, how come it didn't work, right away?
Yeah, exactly.
They were actually getting bad information from the people that were tortured the worst.
And the thing I really hate, too, is that, like, a lot of these people that are all, really for it and everything like that, to call it enhanced interrogation, they should have the balls to call it torture if they're going to actually get behind it and support it.
Yeah. You know what? Where I got that little cliche from was exactly this. Tommy Fitor, spokesman for the National Security Council, said, pardon me, the bottom line is this. If we had some kind of smoking gun intelligence from waterboarding in 2003, we would have taken out Osama bin Laden in 2003.
Exactly.
That's essentially what you said. Yeah. 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 Yep. Okay.
I just wanted to say I love you, Jolene. You're awesome.
Oh, you're sweet. Thank you.
They must have seen that Foxy photograph of you at our...
Peter, what? It's my brains.
It's your brains.
Come on.
Listen, the biology is here as well. You have the fatal combination.
The total package?
The total
Could
package.
Be?
Yeah. Me, I look
why,
like...
Why is it I'm divorced twice then?
the guys couldn't handle
they
you.
Couldn't handle the
you
strong
were too hot
bitch.
To handle.
Yeah.
But, so I look like... So if you go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall, there's beautiful Jolene and me looking like a total nerd that she published.
I posted a picture with Peter with his eyes closed. It wasn't very nice.
I don't care if Peter looks absolutely stupid. I look beautiful.
He called me out.
Yeah.
I love it.
You know,
Peter, you need to send me better pictures.
Yeah. This. What happened last Sunday? The killing of Osama bin Laden. Extraordinarily important with all sorts of implications and suggestions for policy and future and what we've done as a country in the past and what we can do in the future. But, you know, there are other things that are going on. And I want you to stay on the line if you still want to comment on what happened. But, you know, there's something like nearly half of Detroiters can't read. All right?
Yeah. We're not making that up.
No. So that's, that's a disturbing little facet, a little factoid to be sure. But we're living in a country where we have to be concerned about national security. And there's a lot of things we could do to mitigate that, like getting the hell out of those countries, like leaving Iraq, leaving Afghanistan.
Now, did you watch any of Obama's
interview
on 60 Minutes
today? Oh, no, I didn't at all.
Yeah. He said that we have taken have gotten 100,000 troops out of Iraq. He said this.
Yeah, I did. Okay?
And he said that we would be slowly but surely doing the same in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I think that's
the intent. Over the next year, yeah.
I think a lot of it may... I don't think he's going to do it before the election. So that's a long time to have our troops there.
Yeah. Four or five tours.
Yeah, it's a long time. In fact, the interview I'm doing at 1 a.m. is with a woman who has studied PTSD. Am I saying that right? Post-traumatic stress disorder. Uh-huh. And the effects that it has on the men and women who are fighting. And you can imagine the effect that it has in the people of that country as well.
We got an email from Tony, Farmington Hills. And he had a question, and then this is one I'd like to address. If Obama and all of his aides were watching the SEAL operations live on the video feed, how could he come on TV directly after and say there was a big firefight? Now, they didn't watch the feed of the actual, they weren't watching it live as it happened, as they went in.
I thought they were.
No, they were watching, that was like...
Brothers and Sisters.
The video, yeah, they were watching Desperate Housewives.
Yeah.
No, they were watching the lead up to what was going on and things like that. But from what they said, that was not that misled a lot of people, making them think that they were watching it as that happened. And the firefight, was it him that said that? Did he say that? Or was that the media?
I think that was the National Security Advisor. But it might have been, that was it, initially what the Obama administration, I can't remember where their last Sunday night. Maybe I should take a break.
I don't know.
All right, I'll come back when my voice is a little better.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Are you ready to do something about your high credit card debt? Tired of paying double-digit interest rates, late fees, over-limit fees? It's time to stop the madness. Get out of debt the safe and affordable way with Credit Card Relief. With Credit Card Relief, there are no upfront fees, no monthly maintenance fees, and no settlement fees. You don't pay anything until a debt is settled. All with a 90-day money-back guarantee. That's Credit Card Relief. Managed by local attorneys in-state, with workout plans tailored to your debt situation. Get out of debt in months instead of years, all while saving thousands in future bank fees. Call the original Credit Card Relief, where the consultation is free and the results are real.
Call 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282.
How old's the roof on your home? If it's over 15 years old, how much longer will it last before the leaks begin? Think about the damage. Then think about this. If it's time for a new roof, call Sears to get your roofing done right. And if you call Sears right now, you'll save $500. Just call 1-877-938-1414. Sears licensed fully insured contractors install a variety of shingles and styles that are built for long-lasting performance. And you'll save $500 if you call now. So call Sears for a free in-home consultation. 1-877-938-1414. Hurry. Offer ends soon. Not available in all states. Installation provided by Sears authorized licensed contractors. License information available upon request. So if you need a new roof, call Sears Roofing. Call right now and save $500. Call 1-877-938-1414. That's 1-877-938-1414. Sears.
Don't just dream about a brighter future. Go for it. If you want to pursue a career involving technology, look to a leader in technology education, ITT Technical Institute. ITT Tech offers career-focused programs in electronics technology, information technology, and drafting and design. Call 800-741-5123. You can develop knowledge and skills that you can use to pursue opportunities in a variety of career fields. ITT Tech's programs are designed to give you you practical, real-world experience. Classes and day or evening courses meet just a few days each week. Career services are available for students and graduates, and financial aid is available for those who qualify. Would a career involving technology make your dreams come true? Call ITT Tech right now for more information. Call 800-741-5123. 800-741-5123. That's 800-741-5123.
Rates, policy forms, and availability vary by state. Did you know that life insurance rates are near record lows? If you own life insurance or are thinking of buying any, why spend more than you have to? I'm Byron Udell, founder of AccuQuote. Since 1986, we've helped hundreds of thousands of people just like you save a fortune on their life insurance. Here's how we do it. We monitor the products offered by dozens of the most well-respected brand-name life insurance companies you trust so that you get the lowest rates. For example, a healthy 40-year-old can buy $500,000 of 10-year level term for less than $21 a month. 20 and 30-year rates are also available. And don't forget to ask us about the new term life plans that guarantee your money back even if you don't die. Take 5 minutes and call AccuQuote for your free quote at 800-654-2075. Find out how much you can save on your life insurance. Call AccuQuote today at 800-654-2075. That's 800-654-2075.
It's amazing how great your home looks with new carpet or flooring, especially when you get an amazing value from a company you trust. That's why you should call Sears Flooring. With Sears Flooring, you'll save 20% right now. Just call 1-888-491-3939, and Sears Flooring will bring the showroom to you. Sears has a wide range of carpet, tile, hardwood, or laminate to match your style and budget. Your new flooring will be precisely installed, and your satisfaction is guaranteed. So call Sears Flooring for a free in-home consultation. You'll save 20%. Call 1-888-491-3939. Hurry. Offer ends soon. Not available in all areas. Installation provided by Sears Authorized Licensed Contractors. License information available upon request. Call Sears Flooring now and save 20%. Call 1-888-491-3939. 1-888-491-3939. Sears.
I looked at her and I was just wow. She looked so young.
I told her I couldn't believe how smooth her face looks. She's lost, what, 10 years at least?
I look at her and it's like I'm looking at a picture of my wife from 20 years ago. It's incredible.
How are ordinary women across America looking years younger? They've discovered the proven breakthrough called Hydroxytone. It visibly reduces wrinkles, tightens skin, and makes frown lines disappear from view. See for yourself by requesting a risk-free trial of Hydroxytone today. The results are so impressive. Hydroxytone was given away in VIP gift bags at this year's Emmy Awards. Find out how you can try Hydroxytone free for 30 days and shed years from your appearance.
She always looked good to me, but now I can't believe how young she looks.
Call now for your risk-free trial of Hydroxytone. For a limited time, try it before you buy it. 1-800-609-3989. But hurry, when this offer's gone, it's gone. Call 1-800-609-3989. 1-800-609-3989.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to our second hour at 1 a.m. I have a couple of interesting interviews, including one pretty disturbing about the effects of the U.S. wars on our soldiers and the rampant problem of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. We're talking about the Osama bin Laden killing last Sunday and the absolutely meaningless and unimportant question of the photograph of me and Jalene on our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall. Jeff, writing from GOP Hell in Indiana, says, "Hey, Peter and Jalene, love the show. And Jalene, I love your brain and your body."
Wow. Bam. Yeah. Bam.
I got to tell you, never mind. I'm a happily married man. I'm not even going to go there.
You are. You've been married a long time.
I'm not even going to go there. Right. I want to bring up a couple of things. Listen, let me see who's on the line. I can't see who's calling from Dearborn, but Maurice and Lito and Ed and
Maurice has been trying to get in for a while.
Chris calling all the way from Ohio. Well, I wanted to bring up a couple more things. I just hate it, though, that maybe somebody's paying a long-distance bill. So I'm going to get Chris from Ohio first.
Yeah.
Chris, hi. You're on the air with Peter and Jolene. Welcome.
Thank
Chris.
You. I appreciate Thank yeah. you for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
Hey, I'd like to start out by saying Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there.
Okay.
I initially had a comment on the burial at sea.
Sure.
But I did hear your concern over only half of Detroiters knowing how to read.
Yeah.
I'd like to give my opinion on that real quick, if you don't mind.
Sure, please.
It's a parenting issue. We teach our children how to tie our shoes, how to eat properly. It's a parent's job to make sure that their children know how to read.
You know what I think, Chris? I think it's a poverty issue. That's what happens. I mean, the poor, always, no matter where you are, whether it's the slums of Detroit or the slums of Paris or the slums of Japan or the slums of London, that the children of the poor read less, have worse health, commit more crimes, on and on. It's one of the features of poverty.
This is a new report that came out, Peter. 47% of Detroiters are functionally illiterate. So this means they can't fill out basic forms like to try to get a job, read a prescription bottle, how many you should take, your basic everyday needs. And also some of the burbs have high numbers of functionally illiterate, 34% in Pontiac and 24% in Southfield. And a lot of these areas are where there is a high rate of poverty. Just
and
as
in
you said,
terms of being a parenting issue, you know, that poverty destroys families. And you know, within families, there's not the kind of nurturing that, not always, there's a lot of poor families that really pride themselves on what we would think the way that a family and parent or even a single parent would act. But when you're experiencing poverty, you've really got about 2 3/4 strikes against you. And we live in a class society that almost guarantees that everybody
stays where they are.
Mm-hmm. Although now, you know, people kind of all going down. But thank you very much. Thanks for calling from Ohio and giving your opinion. But here are the couple other things that I wanted to just bring up. Remember last week I was telling you about the profits of ExxonMobil. So the fact that all these oil companies, Chevron, Royal Dutch, Shell, and all the rest of them are making stupendous profits means that they're selling their gas for more. In other words, if the cost to them was constant, I mean, even though it was going up and they had to raise their prices, they would have made the same as last quarter or a year ago. But they're gouging us. This is this great transfer of wealth from American families to these wealthy, bloated, exploitative environmentally disastrous companies. The main thing, though, I mean, and we always tend to think most about our pocketbooks, is we're being looted by these companies. So here is the way the Republicans responded. And this is in an article in Think Progress. You can go to thinkprogress.org, a good site. ExxonMobil is by far the most profitable company in the new Fortune 500 list, riding high oil prices to a staggering $30 billion in income in 2010. Exxon made over $10 million more than fellow oil giant Chevron. The three oil giants combined made almost $61 billion in profit in 2010. Pardon me. On May 5th, the Republicans in the House of Representatives celebrated this massive redistribution of wealth from American families to oil executives, because that's what's happened, right? I just filled up. I got this. Mm-hmm. I don't got a very big car. Do I have a standard sidecar?
No, I think it's standard. Yeah.
So it cost me like $65. So rather than this money being for me and my family, it goes to ExxonMobil. Although I went to our pals at Citgo.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Anyway, to celebrating this massive redistribution of wealth from American families to oil executives, 234 Republicans voted to block a bill to eliminate an almost $2 billion annual subsidy that treats oil drilling as, quote, domestic manufacturing. So you get this? We're paying in on our taxes, and what happens is that these companies get subsidized to the tune of almost $2 billion.
Subsidize me! Come on.
The Republicans say this is fine. The House Republicans rejected an effort by Democrats on Thursday to use a procedural maneuver to force a vote on a bill to repeal a key oil industry tax break. The oil industry making just three companies making $61 billion. And the Republicans are saying, let's continue to give them an oil break. I mean, I can't believe that the Republicans get eight votes. You know, I mean, all the rich guys would. As it did in March, House Republicans voted unanimously to defend these wasteful, unaffordable, and unfair oil subsidies, even though several members told their constituents they want to end them. Is there anybody that wants to defend them? I mean, is there anyone other than the oil companies that would benefit from this? I don't get it. You tell me. 313-298-WRIF. All right, let's continue on. Here is Lito, has been waiting patiently at Ypsilanti. Go ahead, Lito. You're on the air. Lito?
Hello?
Lito? Are you there?
That'll probably really make him hang up.
Well, there's a guy. He's there. He's like, yeah, I'm not going to put him on. I'm blowing him up.
Okay.
I can't believe it. He's been waiting for 50 minutes.
Maybe he got, do you think maybe he got distracted here?
Here's a caller. This is Tristandum, if I'm saying it right, in Dearborn.
Hey, how you doing, Peter and Jolene?
How you saying? Great. Oh, Tristan. Yeah.
Tristan.
Yeah, they had an extra syllable.
What's up, Tristan?
Nothing really. I was calling about the comment that Peter had made about Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, which one?
Well, pretty much all of them, I should say.
Okay, go ahead.
Personally, myself, I think it would have been a bad idea to bring him back here for a trial.
Wait a minute, I agree.
Yeah,
I agree with you. That's what I said.
Well, yeah, I'm agreeing with you on that, because I know there's people out there that are disagreeing with our personal views on it. But, I mean, it would have caused way more problems to bring him back for a trial, to where now we have one of the top guys in the ace, the spades deck, the deck of 52, done and over with.
Yeah, remember that deck of cards that they had? That was kind of very bizarre. But that's kind of an awful analogy. I mean, here the United States invades Iraq on the basis of a 100% total lie. You know, destroys the country, creates a million refugees, kills at least 100,000 Iraqi civilians. And essentially is turning it over to, Shiite extremists, where we wind up with the world's largest embassy. So, that deck of cards deal was pretty bad. I mean, real typical of the Bush regime.
Yeah, that wasn't thought out all that well.
And how about these Republicans during this whole thing, really just kind of giving the credit to the armed forces, to Bush, and not even mention President Obama.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, I was listening to that. Or Liz Cheney. She, like, for instance, never mentioned Obama.
Yeah.
Last time I checked, Barack Obama was the commander-in-chief of the armed forces.
Last I checked, he said to whoever he had to say it to, listen, this is top priority. Get in there and get her done.
Yeah. Well,
and guess what? They did.
Tristan, thank you very much. If you go to, all of a sudden I'm blank. Oh, buzzflash.com.
Mm-hmm.
There is an incredible little video there by Bill Maher talking about all this.
Okay.
And yeah. And he's saying, how many people does this black president have to take out before these crackers will cut him some slack?
No doubt. You know,
that's about it. Yeah.
I'll try to post that on our Facebook page.
Yeah, do that. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Here's Maurice in Detroit. Maurice, hi, you're on the air. Oh, did I not do it? No, Maurice, come on. You know, all of a sudden it's very quiet.
It's very quiet.
It's unlike Maurice knows the deal. I'm going to put him back on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's tried very hard to call in tonight. I know that
for
a fact.
Lito's back. Lito, hi, you're on the air. it says, Lito knows, and he doesn't know.
Lito.
Or she doesn't know.
Are you messing with our brain?
No. The brain is messed with. Here is, I don't see who this is, but hi, you're on the air. Former Army Ranger?
Yes.
Who's this? Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Trenton.
What's your name?
My name's Ed.
Go ahead, Ed. You're on the air. Welcome.
I'm welcome, Pete. I've listened to you for a while. But this is about Osama and what we've done. I couldn't have been more proud of the people who did it. I would love to have been the person who pulled the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
But what we have to think about, and probably what's going to be unpopular about my comment, is what we do in these foreign countries and the civil disobedience, shall we say, that we back up to the point of using our firepower and our air power to back these people up. But yet here in the United States, it's exactly opposite. We do what those foreign countries are doing and we find so reprehensible. I mean, whether it be Hutteri, the Michigan militia, and so on and so forth, and this idiot from down south that wanted to burn the Quran.
Yeah, and right.
I don't agree with them, and I don't agree with the Michigan militia, Hutteri, all of them. But what right do we have to suppress their viewpoints to the point of jailing them? What would we do in the United States if a foreign entity used their firepower to back these people up to the point of bombing us, our major cities, killing some of our leadership like we did, and I hate this guy, but
Saddam Hussein. Yeah.
I mean, really?
I actually don't know enough about the militia. Well, I mean, what their charges are. I mean, you know, most government.
Yeah, I get what his whole point is. Another country coming in here and policing our streets.
Right. Yeah,
our crazy people.
The governments usually do not like unsupervised organized groups running around with guns. I mean, they don't seem to mind that it's conservatives. If there ever tried to be a liberal militia or a left wing militia or say an African American militia.
You mean everyone who's running around with a gun in Detroit? Legally? They're unsupervised.
Yeah, but now you totally made me forget my point. What was the other thing? I don't know.
I forgot it all.
But Ed, thank you for your point. I appreciate that.
Hey, I've got an email.
Thanks, Jolene.
Sorry, Peter. First the picture, now this.
Yeah.
Two strikes? Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Debbie Stabenow is introducing a bill this week.
Senator from Michigan, yeah.
Yeah, to end subsidies for the oil companies.
Good for her.
Yeah. Well, let's hope it works.
Well, there one thing that has been good. I like the way this is written in Yahoo News. Remember last week's big story? You know, the one about Obama and where he was born? Didn't he just the country apparently has moved on. Thank you. In a new poll, the number of people who doubt Obama's citizenship has been cut in half since President Obama released his long-form birth certificate, with 86% of Americans believing he was born in America or saying that's their best guess. Just 10% of Americans think the president was born in a foreign country, half the number who thought that in a poll conducted by the Washington Post a year ago. And even those people are mostly birther light, saying it's their suspicion.
My suspicion. Why do they say
I got a suspicion.
Bush.
Yeah. Only 1% said they have solid evidence the president was born somewhere else. What sort of really pisses me off that, in fact, here there was an article in the New York Times, April 29th by Charles M. Blow, and he said, Charles M. Blow is an African American columnist for the Times. He says, President Obama buckled. That was his opinion at the time. And we said that. I mean, it was such an insult that he would even have, he being the president, would even have to do that. But it probably, probably worked out for the best. And now most Americans would not vote for, remember her, Sarah Palin?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the half-term governor of Alaska, the quitter.
Yeah.
And remember this other guy? What was his name? Donald Trump. They are yesterday's newspaper.
God,
boy.
So.
Yeah, out of here. 58% of registered voters surveyed said they would never vote for Palin or Trump for president. What does that mean? That 42% would?
Oh,
that's
gosh.
Scary.
Frightening. Well, considering only about 32% of the population on average votes in every election, we're probably okay.
All right. Let's go back to our phones, that or any other subject. Let's give Maurice another chance here.
Maurice,
you're on the air. Maurice, are you with us?
Hello, Peter, Jolene, how you doing?
You're there.
Success.
Hey, man, you're having a problem with your equipment in the studio tonight, buddy.
Some nights are better than others.
Okay, let's see. You mean with the...
which equipment?
Yeah, sorry. I missed.
His brain's working.
Peter, this is the question.
Yeah, what's up?
Let's go back to the four planes that crashed on 9/11.
Yeah.
My thing is, I never figure out, since, you know, we went through the, you know, hijacking of the plane, they're supposed to make the cockpit secure that nobody can gain entrance because they're supposed to be locked from the inside. How did them dudes get in the cockpit to overpower the pilots to take the pilots out?
They didn't have those locked doors then. That's recent. Used to be.
That's what he's saying.
Sir, I'm going back to when planes used to get hijacked in the 70s. They had locked doors on them then.
Oh, they did? In the 70s? Oh.
Well, they got on planes with guns.
Why the hell did they unlock the doors?
You're going to Cuba.
You know, I used to, the signing out of this dude, to bail out the airplane with all the money. They never found his body. There was a rush of hijacking.
There was.
In the 70s.
There was. They took a lot of planes, a lot of Black Panthers wound up in Cuba. But now they got locked doors. Yeah, I remember going on flights when the Southwest would let people up in the cockpit. I remember.
Yeah, come on up.
They had a kid in there.
Like, here's a sucker.
They had a kid up there singing one time over
yeah,
the.
Yeah, they do sing a lot.
Were we on the plane together?
Together we were.
Maurice, thank you. Thank you. Here, we need our little song, Happiness is a Warm Gun. Hey, can you believe this? A leader of a Southern California white supremacist group was shot and killed on Sunday at his home. The victim, Jeff Hall, 32, was a regional director for the National Socialist Movement, a neo-Nazi group based in Detroit.
What?
What? Yeah, but he was the regional leader of Southern California. Mr. Hall, a plumber and the father of five children, was shot at his suburban home on Sunday morning, said Lieutenant J.B. Brennan of the Riverside Police Department. Lieutenant Brennan said the police responded to reports of gunshots at Mr. Hall's home just after 4 a.m. The police later detained Mr. Hall's son, believed to be 10 years old.
Why are we laughing?
The department said no other suspects were being sought. Couldn't you imagine this guy being kind of a mean dad?
No, not at all.
Say hi, Hitler, kid.
Here's Hitler, MF. I'll show you Hitler.
That is it. Yeah, wait a minute. I thought we weren't supposed to celebrate it. Everybody's dead.
Sick. I know. Yeah. That's bad.
All right. Peter and Jolene, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Tim and Shelby. Hi, Tim. You're on the air. Hey, Tim. What are we having today? Tim, are you there? Listen to that noise.
It's the CIA. I don't know.
You know what? Maybe he's not even there. You know,
now he's gone.
No, I got rid of him.
Okay.
But it says he's talking, but you can't. Oh, wow.
That's weird.
You know, here, somebody else called and says he is talking, but you can't hear.
Really?
Yeah, let's see. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
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 Hey!
Hey.
Hello?
Who's this? Who's this? Hello? Hello?
Night call. You're on the air.
No other talk show in the whole world. Are you there, man?
It's what makes us unique and special.
Is this Lito?
Lito!
Lito!
Hello?
Hey, Lito!
Hello?
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 Hello? Hello, are you there?
Are you there?
Hello?
Hello?
Lito.
Oh, Lito, what's up, man? What's up, Lito?
Hello.
Hello, Lito. Can you hear me?
Hello, Lito.
Lito. Wait a minute. Maybe he can't hear us.
I don't know.
Let's try.
Are you doing anything differently, Peter?
No, let's try. Let's try.
But how could Maurice Hank, just hear us?
Hank in Ypsilanti. Hank, are you with us?
Here.
Can you hear me? Where's the party?
No, they have their radio up. That's why they can't hear us.
Okay, now I can hear.
There
you
are.
Okay. But this is Hank.
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 Okay, I can hear now.
What's
go ahead.
Up,
turn your radio off, man.
Dude, dude. Hey, what's up?
Wait a minute. Maybe you can't hear us.
Turn your radio down.
Off, not
turn
down.
Your radio
off.
Off.
Let's try.
Put him on hold.
Hold on.
Hold on. Yeah. Oh, you got to take a hit.
All right. Hey, Lito, are you there? Lito.
You guys?
Yeah, hey, Lito.
Y'all.
What's happening, man? Lito.
Put the
you know,
phone,
Lito, you got to
have. Down.
There's two parts to the phone. Do you have the earpiece?
Oh, yeah, turn it around. Wait, first put the bong down, and then turn it around.
What?
Lito, are you there? Lito. All right, he's back in the hole.
How high are you?
Let's go to John in Detroit. Hi, John. It's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I had a real bad connection, so I could barely hear what was going on previously.
No.
Well, we can't blame it on Osama bin Laden anymore.
No. Anyways, I know time is short, so I wanted to get through what I wanted to say as quickly as possible. First, on the interrogation, these people who keep pushing that enhanced interrogation stuff, it makes me think they're reliving a power trip from the Dirty Harry movie where he's chasing the guy down in the stadium and trying to beat the information out of him.
Like it's exciting. It's exciting to these people. They need to get their box of Kleenex. You know what I mean?
The second thing is on Thursday, Obama went to Ground Zero to meet with the families of the victims, and Bush. He invited Bush, and Bush declined, at first saying he didn't want to be in the spotlight, and then later it came out that he didn't feel he was getting enough of credit.
I heard that.
Yeah, he was clearing brush. But you know what? Can you imagine, talk about a spirit of unity that would have created? You know,
he could have gotten some points from some folks.
Bush,
Peter.
Even though he and his administration totally dropped the ball and ultimately is, allowed the worst disaster in American history like that to occur, he got after 9/11, 90% support of the American people. And I'll tell you, if the person that really won the 2000 election, Al Gore, had happened on Al Gore's watch, the Republicans would have been screaming for his impeachment, for Gore's impeachment, if it would have been President Gore. So these guys, man, they're just beyond it. All right, thank you very much. You know what? Oh, actually, I wanted to ask him something. Let me, I just want to grab the next person. It's Tim from Shelby Township. Hey, Tim, are you with us? Oh, Tim, come on. Turn your radio off, man. I hate this. Athena and Sarah, are you telling these people to turn off their... listen, you know what? Maybe they can't hear on...
I'm here.
Yeah.
Hi!
Hey, Tim, can you hear on... When you're on hold, can you hear?
Very, very faint.
So that's why everyone's listening to their radio... And the problem
is turning it down. Just be close to your radio and turn it down when you hear us.
Because the problem is that we're on. We used to be on a 7-second delay. I think we're on like a 30-second delay now.
Well, we've got to do it because of all your potty mouths.
And wait a minute. and listen, isn't there kind of like a click that clicking?
Yeah,
you hear that?
Yeah.
Let me ask you. This is not a real personal question, but I asked this for a very specific purpose. You only have to answer it if you want. Tim, how old are you?
I'm 55.
Okay, well then you don't fit this then. Because you know, when you were in school, when I was in school, we learned what's called cursive handwriting. Not writing swear words, but handwriting, right? How to make an A.
Third grade is when we learned the cursive.
You know what? They're not teaching it anymore. And they were asking these students, could you read, they can't read handwriting anymore, young people.
Gosh.
This 22-year-old young woman said, it's kind of cryptic. I'm not used to reading cursive or writing it myself. And a lot of young people cannot read handwriting anymore.
Isn't that crazy? Oh.
Because everybody, what's the main instrument of writing now? The what?
The pewter.
Oh, the pewter, yeah.
The fingers.
Yeah. Anyway, go ahead, Tim. Tell us about oil profits and electric.
Peter, let's talk about you. What you want to talk about, Tim. Yeah.
I would say real quick, Peter Worthy, I've been trying to buy an electric car for 10 years.
Yeah?
Huh?
Obama says he wants the electric car, $3 million on the road in 3 years.
Yeah.
Okay, Tesla Motors makes $20,000 a year. They put me on a waiting list. They got 500,000 orders.
Wow.
General Motors making the Volt. They got 1 million orders. They can't even deal with me. I'm saying to Washington, D.C., when are you going to get serious?
Yeah.
You're doing all this talk on TV about what you're going to do, and you never do it. I want to buy an electric car tomorrow, cash in hand. Can I please buy one?
Well,
yes!
But what about... Yeah, that's...
up to us.
Did you ever see the movie Who Killed the Electric Car?
I have a documentary sitting on my my table.
Yeah.
Well, I don't doubt it.
Hey, but Tim, don't you think they're too expensive?
No.
$40,000?
$40,000, or maintenance free.
Think what you're going to save in the
end.
You're
going to save in 5 years, and you're never. They had a newscaster on Channel 7 and one on Channel 4 that bought them. You know, yeah. Listen to the weather, and they love them. They've got 1,000 miles on. They haven't pulled into a gas station in 2 weeks.
That sounds so beautiful. I drive a hybrid, and so I went from an SUV, which I used to never want to admit, to a hybrid. I wish it were an electric guitar, but a guitar. Well, that's you can. There's a musician in me. Car,
singer songwriter, Jolene Jordan.
Yes. But I love the hybrid. We're going in the right direction. Maybe you can just start with the hybrid.
All right, Tim. Thank you very much. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Who's watching your home when you're not there? It could be a burglar. Burglars prefer to break in when they think no one is home and no one will stop them. Don't be an easy target for intruders. Protect your home with a free security system monitored by ADT, the leader in home security. Pick up your phone now and get free hardware, free medical and fire alerts, and free activation. It's an $850 value. Just call Protect Your Home, your authorized ADT dealer, at 1-877-653-8844. You'll get 24-hour protection, and there's no cost for parts or activation. Call now about a free security system monitored by ADT. Call 1-877-653-8844. $99 installation charge, 36-month monitoring agreement at $35.99 per month. Call for terms and conditions to this offer and protect your home license numbers. Call now, 1-877-653-8844. That's 1-877-653-8844.
When it's raining hard outside, can your roof still keep out the leaks inside? If it's time for a new roof, get your roofing installed the right way with Sears. Call Sears for a free in-home consultation at 1-877-938-1414. You can save $500 if you call right now. Sears licensed fully insured contractors can get your roofing job done right. Sears has a variety of shingles and styles that are built for long-lasting performance, and you'll save $500 if you call now. So, for roofing done right, call Sears for a free in-home consultation at 1-877-938-1414. Hurry, offer ends soon. Not available in all states. Installation provided by Sears authorized licensed contractors. License information available upon request. That's Sears Roofing. Call right now and save $500. Call 1-877-938-1414. That's 1-877-938-1414. Sears.
101.1 WRIF.
What's up, everybody? This is Sully from Godsmack.
Hello, Motor City. This is Mike Dupree from Pearl Jam.
Hello, Motor City. This is Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin. Your radio's locked on 101 WRIF. If it rocks, it's on the roof.
Everything. Rocks. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much. It's our final segment, so if you want to get on the air, please do it. We've been talking most of the night, although we are open for any subject you'd like to talk about the killing last week of Osama bin Laden. He's moved off the board once and for all. Mm-hmm. I hope his day and what he represents hopefully is gone. I suspect it probably won't be,
yeah.
But the way of changing things has been altered by events in the Middle East, in Tunisia and Egypt, and the struggles that are going on now in all these other countries.
Syria. And the less we, not us, but our government and our armed forces do, the less damage they do around the world, the less that's going to happen.
Yeah. Tony writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. First and foremost, let's go Red Wings. Well, let's not put it in order like that. Although, I don't know, some people may think.
As far as Detroit sports go, and also the Tigers with Verlander throwing, pitching that no-hitter.
Yeah. Almost a perfect game.
Yeah.
Only one person reached base.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was amazing.
I can't believe we know this stuff.
Yeah. I'm
proud of us.
Well, why? But anyway, here's what Tony says. If Obama and, pardon me, and this is what you were talking about, and all his aides were watching the SEAL op live on video feed, then how come on TV directly after that Obama said there was a big firefight, which there wasn't? It also was reported that the compound Osama was living in cost millions and was built in 2005. Don't you think this place really looked like an old rundown shack?
And it did.
It did. The big point was made of Islamic rules about the burial at sea. How many Muslims are ever buried at sea? Michael Moore at michaelmoore.com. Mm-hmm. He said, oh, yeah, that all I've seen that a lot. He says, you know, my Muslim friends, they take them up in a helicopter and dump them in Lake Erie.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought there was something in the tradition where if you were killed on land, you need to be buried on land.
Beats the hell out
one?
Of me.
Yeah.
No, it beats me. There's very little to make conservatives happy these days, but the Prime Minister of Canada, and since we're right on the border, everyone knows the name of the Prime Minister of Canada, right? Don't you all? Yeah, Stephen Harper actually won an absolute majority in the House of Commons of Canada, which he was ruling as a minority prime minister prior to that. And that's sort of depressing for a lot of people. But there's a lot of aspects to it that are interesting and have some relevance to what we are always talking about. A party, a labor-based party, a party that's based on labor unions, the New Democrats, won 102 seats. The Conservatives hold 167. And actually, this is important that tempering Mr. Harper's ambition is the fact that his party captured only about 40% of the popular vote. While the Conservatives worked to build ties to members of ethnic communities in and around Toronto, many of its election victories there came because the Liberals and the New Democrats split the left of center vote. So about 60% of the electorate in Canada is left of center. But given the way things voted there, a conservative is in. But Prime Minister Harper flatly ruled out substantial change to Canada's public health care system, a program that the right wing doesn't like, but he's not going to touch that. All right. We were talking about cursive writing, and that's not swearing when you write stuff down, but that increasingly young people do not know how to write. Handwriting is what we used to call it, but cursive, I guess, in the way that they taught it, and that a lot of young people can't even read it anymore.
They're not being taught, and it's going by the wayside.
So let's see. Don and Troy had a comment on that. Don, hi. You're on the air. Hi, Don. You're on,
about the cursive thing. I'm in middle school, and I haven't done any cursive since third grade.
Yeah, it was third grade when I learned, I remember. Really? So you're on the computer, huh?
Yeah, kind of. I'm just not really used to it. Well, I know S and maybe D, T.
Confirmation of the story.
Yeah, so, I mean, you can't really read it very well.
No.
So when you write notes, you write it just in capital letters.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, well.
And one thing I really don't like is, like how on checks, if you need to, like, write out the numbers, you have to do it in cursive, and I don't know how to do that anymore.
You know what? I don't know that that's true.
Yeah, I think you can do it any old way now. Yeah.
You could write like 125 and no $100. You could write that. You could just print it out. I mean, I find myself, it's interesting. I start to
use. And you better get used to it because you're in middle school. You're going to write a lot of checks in your life.
Everything I write is cursive, except almost all of my capital letters are printed. And increasingly, I intermix them in many ways.
Yeah, I just did that. There's regular print, there's my cursive.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay. Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead. What?
I used to do that back in fifth grade.
Yeah.
Way back in fifth grade.
Me too.
What are you in? Are you in seventh grade, eighth grade?
Seventh.
Seventh.
Yeah.
Right on.
Wow.
Well, hey, you're listening to the best show in Detroit.
Thank you, Don. Thank you. Don't you got school tomorrow? So that's interesting. I wonder. I never even thought of that.
Yeah.
I know.
I saw this article.
A friend of ours, who you know as well, who's head of this archive in Ann Arbor, who is of Irish and Mexican descent, and she took a class in Yiddish, the old European Jewish language, so she could read the handwriting of Yiddish speakers in the United States.
Really?
Which is pretty tough.
Well, I can only imagine.
Yeah. So
did she pass?
So now, I don't know. So now, though, that you know, people are going to have to be struggling to say, boy, what did those people, when they were writing stuff out in the 20th century, I can't read this stuff. But I'm looking at, well, you know what? I'll bet you that it's probably easier to read everybody's printing than everyone's handwriting.
You mean cursive?
What did I say?
Printing versus handwriting.
Well, or cursive handwriting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Right. Because I'll bet you if you, you know, some people's handwriting is so bad you can't even read
Doctors.
It. Doctors. Yeah, right. But if they printed it out, everybody can read people's printing.
Yeah, my doctor prints out all the prescriptions.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, you can read them.
Here's Mike in Clarkson. Hey, Mike, you're on the air. Welcome.
Wait, click.
Yep, I did. Hope this we're not back. Yeah, hey. There we go. Yeah, go ahead, Mike. You're on the air.
The static is really bad. Hey, listen. Since the SEALs went in and took out Obama or Bin Laden, what's the chances of us going in and taking out Hannity and Limbaugh next?
Oh, my gosh. They're going to take themselves out. And I don't mean literally like suicide or anything, but come on. These guys, can't they just...
I'm sick of these two-faced bastard conservatives that will pat Bush on the back for the same thing if this would have happened under his administration.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It is funny. I always listen to this one really awful right-wing show when I come in for this show. And all it was criticism of why wouldn't he show the body and why
the carnage.
Yeah, let's show the body and like I say and piss these people off even more.
Yeah, and meanwhile they're still spelling it Usama. Did you notice that?
You know what? I think that is interchangeable.
Well, it is, but Osama bin Laden spells it Osama bin Laden.
Yeah.
Someone wrote in. Here's a good one for you, Peter. Osama is not dead. It's all a lie to interrogate him for months and possibly years, as did the thinking of all terrorists. They told everyone he is dead so not to have questions or plausible deniability to the president. But I'm sure the CIA has Osama and has him locked away where no one can find him.
Who knows? Nothing would surprise me.
Enjoy.
Thank you, Mike. Yeah. Well, I suspect that he, in fact, I don't even suspect,
He's dead.
He's dead. He's toast. Here's Pete in Ypsilanti. Pete, hi, it's Pete. Angeline, you're on the air.
Yeah, Pete, I was wondering if these kids can't write in cursive. How do they sign their names?
Well, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because where did that article go to? This article's too long, but I remember there was something in the article about the only thing they do is kind of scribble their handwriting. I don't know about you, but the only time I don't even write checks anymore.
I do once in a while.
I still do.
Well, here's what happens at our house. I mean, I charge almost everything. My wife writes all the checks. But when I don't know about you, but when I sign a like a charge card or even, you know, when you go into some of those places, you got to sign that little pad, that electric pad. Mm-hmm. I just scribble. I don't even write my name. I just go...
That's all you really need to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like a doctor's autograph, sure.
Yeah.
I'm curious. And something is definitely messed up with your phone system. Because before the girl answered, I got a bunch of static. And then when she put me on hold, it was really static and you could barely understand what you
said. Well, I apologize to people.
We're putting engineering on the case. The great news is that we here at Greater Media Detroit have the best engineers in radio in this town. So they'll have it all fixed up. Also, an email came in from Harold and he said...
Hey, Pete, thank you. Appreciate
it. Here's the problem solved about kids signing their name, Peter. Because he said, actually... Jules, checking is going to disappear. Getting, they're already getting rid of it. Debit, credit, gift cards are replacing it. And then he said RFID and other chips.
Oh, well, that always used to be the bedrock root of authenticity, someone's signature.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
No, I don't know. Somebody else is going to address that as well. Vaughn and Adrian. Hi, Vaughn, you're on the air.
Yeah, I think you already answered my question. I was just curious if they don't know how to sign, how do they sign their name? You have to have a signature.
Yeah.
I heard about all the, you know, the scribble and whatnot, but you're still going to have a signature for contracts or anything like that, you know?
Well, here, in this article, might people who write only by printing in block letters or perhaps with a sloppy, squiggly signature be more at risk for forgery? Is the development of a fine motor skill thwarted by an aversion to cursive handwriting? What happens when young people who are not familiar with cursive have to read historical documents like the Constitution? Well, it's printed out. I don't know. Maybe I read this article quite a while ago, so I'm not even...
All they have to do is do the Google.
Yeah,
that's going to be a tough one. But I would think it would be pretty easy to forge something if you don't have your own proper way of handwriting.
Yeah.
You know, your own form, your own style of something.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder, is forgery still a big threat? I mean, that used to be people would forge checks, but I wonder how much of that even goes on anymore. I mean, most everything now is Internet fraud, right, or credit card
absolutely.
Fraud.
Electronic, but I would think... But if it gets to that point, that'll be a weak point. So I'm sure they'll start attacking that, again, or more.
Well, Vaughn, here is another. I'm just kind of listening to you and trying to read this at the same time. My wife said, you never give me full attention. Well, Sally Bennett, an 18-year-old freshman at Central Arkansas College, signs her name in all capital letters. How about that? And never gave any thought to it until she took the ACT college entrance exam. Pardon me. Students must copy a prompt with explicit instructions that they do not print. So the classroom of test takers tried cursive. Some people in there couldn't remember. I had to think about it for a minute. It was kind of hard for me to remember.
That's so bizarre to me.
Yeah.
See, I'm in a business where I'm going to need a signature to leave you a package.
No.
If you try to print, I'm not going to be able to leave you a package. You're going to need a signature.
You mean like UPS or?
A courier company.
Yeah.
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 And some of those, you'll sign it and they'll say, what is that?
But you know.
What did you just sign? What does that say?
Right. But that's their own form of whatever. I can't just take it off of them printing it because I can print it just fine. You know, they could say that I did that instead of them, what have you.
True.
But you know what?
I have some kind of signature as well.
When I get, I get a lot of books shipped to my house and all that for, that I use for potential authors for interviews and all. And when someone comes, I don't write my name like once in a while. I mean, I probably write 3 checks a year. And I know my signature is on file at the bank, so all of a sudden I got to remember, how the hell do I do that? But when a UPS guy comes, or what's the other big ones?
FedEx
or something like that. I'm kind of doing it with my hand. I don't even really write my signature. I just go scribble, scribble, scribble across it. And
let's Peter face it. It's your autograph.
Yeah, you're not a doctor now. Come on.
He's a celebrity.
Yeah.
God.
You gotta go to school and get a doctorate and all that good stuff.
Doctorate. First I gotta get my bachelor's.
I have more college education than Warby.
I have next to none. I never was a good student. All right, Vaughn, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. I bet he did not work for UPS.
Why do you say that?
Well, because
he said a courier company.
Well, I know, because UPS is unionized and the rest of them aren't.
Oh.
And probably someone who didn't work for a unionized company may be a little more apprehensive about mentioning their company in public. Like if you have the protection of a union.
Yeah. Whatever.
We don't like we part your hair. You're out of there. Here's Craig in Lincoln Park. Craig, hi. You're on the air.
How are you doing tonight, Peter?
We're good.
We were just talking about this tonight, about things that people don't, the kids don't do anymore, like the handwriting.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes.
At the bar. I love it.
We actually started about, remember strikeout when you were a kid?
Strikeout?
Yeah, remember with the X on the wall?
It's a game.
Yeah, it was a baseball game. Strikeout.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
How kids just, everything's computers now.
Sure.
Everything. Okay, my other thing was...
Their poor little brains.
I know. They just sit in front of computers all day or video games.
And they need to, their parents need to get out of the house. It's so sunny out there. Get out of here.
Oh my God, I used to run home from school to get my homework done so I could go outside and play ball or play hockey or anything but stay home, you know?
Yeah.
So, okay, and the Osama bin Laden thing. Why did we grant them this 24-hour thing with his being buried? He didn't think about that on September 11th, did he?
Well, I thought they just...
Well, they had to get his ass out to see it.
They didn't do 24 hours. Didn't they just dump him immediately?
Well, I mean, but isn't the Muslim faith...
Oh, before 24. I don't know. You know, maybe they figured...
They're trying not to probably inflame the world even further, as we've been talking.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, I get totally what you're saying.
Yeah. We didn't... I don't think we got hurt by that at all, did we?
No.
Yeah. I know. I mean, listen, people are so angry and so filled with a desire for retribution that there's nothing that could have been done to him or his body or anything like that that would have upset most people. But, you know.
Why didn't you dismember him first?
Yeah.
You know?
Draw and quarter him.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Disembowel.
That it's all worked out. It's all worked out. And, he's off the stage of history. He goes up there with the pantheon of the horrible people of history. And
he and Hitler.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. A few little, I don't know, these aren't really housekeeping
things.
Well,
there's always items. We didn't get to a lot of items last week because of this.
Former Attorney General. I mean, this sounds like such ancient history. Former U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft is joining the security firm once known as Blackwater. And he's supposed to, you know, I actually don't have it in this news item, but this was another one of Bush's cronies, that he was the guy.
He was a joke.
Remember, he covered up the statues of justice.
Lady Justice.
Because they had a bare breast showing.
Their boobies were showing, and he spent $8,000.
For drapes.
On drapery to cover their boobies.
I wonder if they're still there.
No, I think they've been taken down.
Yeah. But you know what? He claimed that the liberal media was purposely what he would.
He'd be sitting there giving a speech, and the boobies would be right above his head.
Yeah.
Ah.
Except, don't you think he could have moved?
That was my devil laugh. Jeez.
Don't you think he could have? It is.
He could have moved. Yeah, you're right, Peter. Just kind of adjust. We're going to go over on this half of the room. What a dummy.
Yeah.
So, Peter. So he does all of these horrible things while he's in there. And what does he do? Land a sweet job with a mercenary corporation.
Yeah, yeah. Here, this is actually some good news. A federal appeals court last Tuesday, in fact, this was even a week ago Tuesday, ordered a new sentencing hearing for Mumia Abu-Jamal. He was convicted of killing a police officer in Philadelphia in 1981. So that was 30 years ago. And the court found for the second time that the death penalty instructions given to the jury in his 1982 trial were potentially misleading. This has been an incredible case that has gone on for a generation.
Unreal.
Mumia Abu-Jamal was a young Black Panther, and he came up. There's two stories, two narratives there. His story was that he came upon this police officer that was beating his brother.
Yeah.
Then what happens next is his defenders say that that somebody else came and shot the cop.
Mm-hmm.
The jury found that in fact, Mumia Abu-Jamal had done it. And it occurs to me, he was convicted of first-degree murder. And this happened in 72 seconds. So he has spent 30 years in essentially in solitary confinement.
Yeah.
You would think that even if he was guilty, and there's a range of of
thought,
opinion
emotions,
on this.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously the people that are defending him say that he's not guilty, that someone else has even confessed to it, that all the police witnesses that perjury was suborned. The judge was this absolute, total, and complete racist. There's no doubt about that. And
I have a pin with his face on it.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's been huge demonstrations. He's a couple of times come close to being sentenced, but not, well, he was sentenced to be executed. that there aren't any police on the Philadelphia force any longer that were even
there
mm-hmm. at the time. They've all retired since. And yet still, they want Mumia Abu-Jamal dead.
Yeah. He's become one of these kind of, I don't know, hot button.
I would almost think people. That given that there was so much prosecutorial and judicial misconduct,
yeah,
that he could say plead guilty and they could say time served. And
yeah.
You're out of there.
30
years.
The man,
it must be near 60 now or something
yeah.
like that. You know?
He has quite the support group, that which is a true testament to what support can do.
Whoop, we got to go, too.
All right, Peter.
Hey, Sarah, Athena, thank you so much for doing everything you do in the other room, taking the calls. We will report that all the phone calls on hold were sounded bad. Jalene Jordan, thank you, as usual.
But you all sounded great.
Yeah.
Thank you for your opinions.
Have a couple of interesting interviews, including one on PTSD that's coming up right after these. We'll talk next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Who's watching your home when you're not there? Protect your home with a security system monitored by ADT, the leader in home security. Just call Protect Your Home, your authorized ADT dealer. Call now and get $850 of hardware and activation for free. Call 1-877-653-8844. That's 1-877-653-8844. $99 installation charge. 36-month monitoring agreement at $35.99 per month. Call for terms and conditions and Protect Your Home license number.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, these last few days have been pretty memorable with the killing of Osama bin Laden, and everything that brings up once again raises the memories of 10 years ago. All of that just marked indelibly in our lives, and just as I think all of us will be able to say where we were when we heard about September 11th, probably most of us will be able to say where we were when we heard the news that Osama bin Laden has been killed. The scars from violence, the scars from war are tremendous. I think most of us know that. The post-traumatic syndrome, the PTSD, we'll get into that a little better, the post-traumatic stress disorder, there you go, is something that all of us know about. It used to be called shell-shocked back in World War I. We're quite aware that any number of our veterans have experienced this, particularly with long tours and a lot of the combat involving direct military experience with civilians. And it's important that we get a handle on this. There's a book that has just come my way, I think is an excellent presentation of the issues involved. It's called Fields of Combat, Understanding PTSD Among Veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. The author is Aaron P. Findlay, and Aaron Findlay is a medical anthropologist and health services researcher who has previously worked with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and Boston University Medical Center. She's currently a health research scientist with the South Texas Veterans Healthcare System and adjunct assistant professor in the Division of Clinical Epidemiology at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio, Texas, and that's where we're reaching her in her office. Aaron Findlay, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you very much for having me.
That almost exhausted me, introducing you.
Sorry, it's a very long list.
I think it's important because well-deserved that we look at the work you've done, but also that it centers you in the midst of this. Is PTSD, the post-traumatic stress disorder that our veterans are experiencing, is it at crisis level, or is it something that's on the margins of what we should be aware of?
I think it's something we absolutely need to be aware of. It is something we are seeing among a lot of veterans who are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan now. It is something that we will probably expect to continue seeing over the coming years. So I think it's really something that needs to be at the focus of our attention.
Does this have any unusual quality to it? As I said earlier, certainly what people experienced, men primarily, although now it's extended to women in our modern mm-hmm. army, but that men have experienced ever since there was war, the idea of killing somebody, even if they're the enemy, let alone so-called collateral damage, seeing that first up must be pretty dramatic and stressful on any individual. So is what's happening now and what you chronicle in Fields of Combat, does it have any new dimensions to it, or is it what we used to call shell-shocked?
It is basically basically the same thing as what we used to call shell shock. I mean, if you look at, of course, PTSD was not called that until 1980, so it's a relatively new term. But what we're describing, the basic disorder, has been essentially the same over time, because it's really based in who we are as human beings, both physiologically, emotionally, etc. However, because the wars have gone on as long as they have, I think we're likely to see a real increase in rates this particular set of conflicts.
Well, many of us, civilians, were horrified that some of these men and women get sent back into combat, the men into combat, endless times. Yet in other wars, the men were there until the war ended, like the Vietnam War. Or no, actually, I'm not remembering, but I know during World War II, you were in for the duration. And
certainly during World War II, you were.
Yeah.
You were. And I think you have different challenges and pros and cons either way. This way, we don't have men and women being away from their families for years on end, which can be very destructive. On the other hand, there is a challenge associated with going back and forth between two environments with very different priorities, very different requirements, very different stresses, and that is unto itself extremely stressful.
Yeah, I know in Vietnam there was, I'm trying to remember whether it was a song or a poem, but it was called 19, which was the average age of the Vietnam draftee. And I was just looking in the New York Times the other day, and they had a list of men that were killed in Afghanistan over the last week, a week ago. And here were men, 40, 37, 33. Yeah. Is there a difference? I mean, do you experience war better or worse when you're, well, either way, younger or older?
I don't know that it's ever easy, certainly, but the median age of our service members now is quite a bit older than it was in Vietnam, and that does seem to have some protective effect. If you're a little bit older when you go to war, you have more experience of life, you have more coping strategies at your disposal, and so younger age does seem to be a risk factor for developing combat PTSD.
You know, I'm thinking 50 years ago or 100 years ago, most of the experience of war was pretty far removed. That is to say that men would read about it. And usually it was presented as very heroic, in patriotic and nationalistic manner. And then when the realities of war, World War I or whatever, the realities of it were hit you immediately. But now, I mean, I don't think as many movies as I've seen, as many accounts I've read of what you're discussing, Aaron Finley, in Fields of Combat, I'm sure it's nothing like it. But everybody going into it must have some idea. I mean, I've seen enough war movies with heads exploding and bodies blown apart to know it's not just going to be, you know, rushing up San Juan Hill. So the point being, are men any more prepared for this than they were when it was just sort of heroicized?
You know, that's a really interesting question, and that's not something I've thought about before.
I'm sorry.
No, it's wonderful. I mean, I think the preparedness we talk about most frequently, and the preparedness that seems to be the most protective, is the military training that service members get before combat. And I think that probably has a lot more to do with dealing with the actual realities on the ground. I think seeing the pictures on the movies may convince us we think we know what we're getting into, and then it's very different when we actually get there. So I think actually a different kind of preparation is probably more significant in that.
Well, I want to get to the men who you've interviewed and who are the subject of your book, Fields of Combat, Understanding PTSD Among Veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. But let's talk about the vast majority of us, the 99% of us who don't go to war, and how we perceive of these men. Certainly, we always talk about honoring veterans. On the other hand, there's sort of also a sub rosa perception of a lot of combat veterans of, gee, I hope they don't explode, you know, right when they're back home here. Is that very prevalent among the general population? That perception is that they're injured goods and could explode at any time?
You know, I think it is. I think it is. And that certainly was something that the veterans I was working with mentioned a lot, was feeling like they had to convince their family and friends that they weren't going to go climb a tower and start shooting people. And also sort of when they began to experience their own distress, being worried, okay, what does this mean about me that I'm having these feelings if this is the perception of veterans that we have? So I think it's very important to do that work of educating the public to understand that veterans are people who have been through often some very challenging experiences that have required them to acquire a set of skills in combat that may or may not translate well into civilian life, but that does not mean they have suddenly lost all self-control and become raving maniacs. And I think the myth of the crazy vet is really destructive. You know, the veterans I know are people who have worked very hard to be good citizens and good fathers, good husbands, good mothers, good wives, good people. And to have to deal with that kind of perception is very disheartening.
Is the man, and let's stick with the men, unless I'm off on the wrong foot here, that the man who joins the service, no matter how much gratitude the nation expresses to him, is he the average man in terms of his class or race or what have you? Or are these often people, and I know this is true, sometimes guys go into the service because they're totally rootless or they're on a bad road with drugs or petty crime. And so I wonder if some of the problems that they experience are ones that, you know, I'm sure their combat experience increases, but would have difficulties anyway. And that's why we find both Vietnam and now Iraq and Afghanistan, that vets wind up homeless and high degree of emotional stress, high crime rate and all of that. Could that be? Or is it simply because they've experienced war?
I think to some extent sort of both of those things are true. I think you see the whole range of people going into the military for a very wide range of reasons, economic reasons, college opportunities, career opportunities, wanting to serve their country, etc. I think there is a minority of people, I wouldn't know what percentage to put on it, but I do think it's a relatively small minority, who go in because they think that combat might be their sort of thing. And it may be that those folks are a little bit different in terms of who they would have been outside of the military. At the same time, you have folks who go into the military and maybe they don't have a lot of structure when they're young or they're really struggling, and the military helps them get on a very straight and narrow track. So it's complicated. I think it goes both ways.
My guest is Erin P. Findlay. She's written Fields of Combat, Understanding PTSD Among Veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. It's published by Cornell University Press. You can go to cornellpress.cornell.edu, and there'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E. Just to be 100% sure that that everybody knows what we're talking about, let's describe post-traumatic stress disorder, because, you know, how broad is the category? You could say, well, every time a vet gets angry, we say, PTSD, right? Tell me its clinical definition, if you would, and what one should look for in themselves or family members or what have you.
Sure. So post-traumatic stress disorder, obviously the first criteria is that someone would have been exposed to a trauma. And trauma is really defined as either being in a life-threatening situation oneself or a situation where your bodily integrity was really threatened, or witnessing that happening to someone else, and that event really causing a lot of fear, helplessness, or horror is the clinical definition of that event. And then it's very natural and normal to expect that people are going to have certain experiences after an event like that. They may think about it a lot and not really be able to put it out of their mind. They may have nightmares. They may have trouble sleeping. But if those things don't start to resolve within a month or so, then we start to look at, well, okay, this may be PTSD. And symptoms would be irritability, quickness to anger, feeling on edge all the time, feeling like you're not safe even in safe environments like Walmart or in your home, And then also avoiding situations or places that remind you of the trauma itself. So there's a wide variety of symptoms, but that's basically the criteria.
Well, on the leaf of your book, on the cover, on the jacket, The Fields of Combat, this, I don't know why this quote among so many in your book struck me, and that says this one veteran that you interviewed for Fields of Combat, whenever I look at people back here at home, I know what they're going to look like dead. I know what they look like with their brains blown out or jaws blown off or eyes pulled out. When I look at somebody, I see that to this day. That must be pretty frightening imagery.
Well, I think it really gets at something very important, which is PTSD isn't just mental and emotional. It's a really physiological experience, too. The whole way that veterans with PTSD experience the world and take in sensory information has really changed. This same veteran who gave that quote, I thought this was a wonderful example. He talked about walking down the hallway at work here in San Antonio, and it's a white hallway, and on the wall there are these different colored tile squares, and how shocked he would be and how he'd have to catch himself walking down this hallway, because out of the periphery of his vision, he would catch one of those colored squares, and because it seemed out of place, he would go into alert a little bit, thinking, okay, what is that? I need to be aware of that all the time. So it's a very physical experience as well, and I think that's something we don't talk about as much.
Well, this your book, Fields of Combat, is not just a report. I mean, it has to do with your professional work as well, with the South Texas Veterans Healthcare System and also your work at the University of Texas Health Science Center. So what is being done? We hear repeatedly that PTSD is not being caught in time. The Army isn't stepping in when it should. I think I'm remembering this from a while ago, although there seems to be, and I think your book may be more evident of that, is that, that we're beginning to understand what a problem this is. So, well, I mean, there's a lot of questions in there. On the professional level, is the Army, is the Veterans Administration working well with this now, or is there still a need?
I think there is going to continue to be a need, no matter how well we work with it, for some period of time. I think we have come an astonishingly long way in 10 years. We have learned so much. There has been so much dedicated to research to make sure that we are making good decisions about how to prevent as much as possible, how to catch as quickly as possible. And we have incredibly effective treatments now. And that's really a game changer in terms of what PTSD is going to mean for this generation of veterans. That does not mean, however, that we don't still have a lot to learn and a long way to go to make sure we are doing the best we can to prevent, to catch, and then to treat every single service member and veteran who is going to need it.
Now, PTSD has been recognized for a long time, and there were stories a few years ago that men in the service still that had these symptoms, not veterans, but men that were still on active duty, that when they reported to their like commanding officers that they were experiencing emotional problems, they were essentially told, come on, toughen up, man up, or accused of trying to slack off. But that's beginning to change, hasn't it, as I remember some reports? Hopefully it is. What's the situation now in terms of the top-down orders about this?
I really think the situation is changing. Top-down leadership has absolutely understood over the past number of years that you cannot maintain a fit fighting force over 10 years without learning to deal effectively with this, because you simply can't keep people from having emotional difficulties if we're talking about very long periods of time. It's much more efficient to take care of those people so that they can do what they need to do as far as mission readiness. However, cultural change takes time, and I think individual leaders may have different responses at different times. I have seen folks talk about leaders who were absolutely made the difference in getting them into treatment and really saving their lives. I had one fellow talk about his sergeant sitting next to him on the plane when he was sent home because he was suicidal, and really taking care of him and making sure he got into care. in other units, that hasn't always been the case. So I think we are making progress. We need to keep paying attention to this.
Well, Aaron Finley, do you is this because you know one of the things your qualification for looking at all this is that you're a medical anthropologist. So is this a group study, or do you actually do individual care as well?
I do not do individual care. I am fortunate to get to work with clinicians who provide amazing care, and they have taught me a lot, but I do not provide care.
And how is it treated? Is this individual therapy, medication, group therapy, or all of the above?
Really, all of the above. If you look at the treatments that we know work, because we have 20 years of medical research to show that they work, there are two talk therapies that really jump to the front of the list. One is individually based. One combines individual and group therapy. And then we also know that there are medications, particularly antidepressants, that can play an important role in supporting the effectiveness of those treatments. So there's a lot of complementarity there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a wide range of options for veterans seeking care.
My guest is Erin Finley. She's written Fields of Combat, Understanding PTSD Among Veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. You're listening to the Peter Werby Show. We just have a few minutes left to talk about this. You know, as we were talking, I had the impression, and I'm still just talk about memory and the way these vets do, just that quote I read about the vet who says that every time he looks at people back home, he knows what they're going to look like, dead with their heads blown apart and all that. And so he must have seen that. He must have been there, and perhaps, you know, you think about when you're involved in fighting insurgents, how civilians are right among the people you're fighting, and you wind up, you've attacked a village, and you wind up and you say somebody in your group has killed a lot of kids and women and elderly people, and all the insurgents have fled, and I'm sure that, I mean, it would seem, rather than it almost being a syndrome or a disorder, it would almost seem like the natural human reaction to that. Or if you saw dead insurgents with their heads blown apart, I'm sure that's nothing that I would forget. As I said that, a couple things flashed through my brain of accidents that I've seen years and years ago. So those stay with me all my life, let alone, you know, you having a direct hand in it. So, I know that the symptoms are bad, but it almost seems more like a natural reaction than a disorder, if you know what I mean.
I absolutely know what you mean, and I think you're right on. To a certain extent, it's absolutely a natural reaction. But if it gets to the point where, for example, a lot of the veterans I've worked with have gotten out of the military and they want to go to college, but if you can't study for your tests because that's all you can think about, then you're really starting to have a problem. Or if you can't remember to go to your meetings at work because you can't get those images out of your head, then that's where these kind of symptoms start to really interfere with function and inhibit your ability to live a good life. So I think that's where we have to make the difference is.
Mm-hmm.
We would not expect people to be unaffected by these experiences. That's not a reasonable thing to expect. But if you are not able to bring them into the rest of your life so that you continue to function, then you may need some extra help to get there.
So when we have, I was thinking, and answered my own question, that when we're just 2 days past when President Obama announced the killing, that Osama bin Laden has been killed, can a society have PTSD? I mean, to some extent, have we all been suffering from that? I mean, I just said that, and I just saw people jumping out of those windows. Yeah. So is it does it have a social manifestation? I mean, it obviously doesn't inhibit me. So, I mean, I think that's the distinction you made, right? As long as it doesn't cripple my capacity to function.
Right. No, I think there's a useful distinction to be made from what we might call shared suffering. So September 11th was something we all suffered together. And we all watched that together, and that's something we shared. So I think there was really a shared suffering. But PTSD is something different. It's really taken to a whole another level, and it's something that we can do a lot to help people recover from. So I think it's important to focus on those folks who are most in need and make sure they get the care that they need.
You know, insurance companies are, you're probably wondering where I'm going with this. When insurance companies are figuring out actuary tables for a year, they're figuring, well, we're going to have to pay death benefits in 1,800 automobile accidents of the insurees that we have. So in the same manner, as you said, Aaron Finley, that that as this war stretches on, and even though President Obama is talking about leaving Afghanistan, it continues that we absolutely know we're going to have more people suffering PTSD. Is there any way we can in advance try to limit the damage that is being done to our soldiers, or does it just go with the terrain and we've got to pick up the wreckage after?
I think we're doing a lot more now to try and understand what we can do to prepare service members for that experience in terms of not just excellent military training, but resiliency training, teaching coping skills before folks go into combat, which can maybe help them deal with the experiences as they arise. But it's going to be a while, and I don't know what else we can do. I think to some extent, war has human costs, and this is part of that human cost.
Yeah, even the victors. Right?
Even the victors.
The book is Fields of Combat, Understanding PTSD Among Veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. If you're a vet, if you have a family member who's a vet, or if you want to understand the cost, this is a terrific book to read. It's published by Cornell University Press. You can go to cornellpress.cornell.edu. They've got a lot of good titles beside this one as well. This one will be listed directly on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Aaron Finley, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much. Thanks for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. Boy, every city has such a history, and most of us don't know much about our own history of the city except in broad terms, perhaps more, sometimes people, a couple of weeks. That's where our historic memory goes back. But history is fascinating to me, and I think to many of you as well. It's one of the reasons you listen to this broadcast, because we talk about our history so much, our country and our state and our community. And there's a book that just come my way that is absolutely fascinating, that contains so much it is actually challenging, extraordinarily challenging to me, to how are we going to even get a broad overview of this into a 25-minute broadcast. With me is one of the authors, co-authors, three people put this incredible history together. The book is called The Color of Law, Ernie Goodman. Now, that's the subject of this book, but the subtitle is Ernie Goodman, Detroit and the Struggle for Labor and Civil Rights. And Ernie Goodman was an incredible attorney. In fact, one of the nation's prominent defense attorneys. He worked for workers and militant poor throughout his 50-year history, and it contains almost the history of the middle section of the last century. Joining me in the studio is Steve Babson. He's one of the co-authors, along with Dave Riddle and David Elsula, two activists in the labor movement for many years. Steve Babson has published six books, including Working Detroit, The Making of a Union Town, and also Lean Working, Empowerment and Exploitation in the Global Auto Industry. He's currently the newsletter editor for Local 675 of the American Association of University Professors, American Federation of Teachers. And that represents the faculty and academic staff at Wayne State University. Steve Babson, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Well, thanks. A pleasure to be here.
What an incredible book. What an incredible man. I mean, how do we place Ernie Goodman? I'm going to leave it to you to begin this discussion. And this seems like almost an impossible question. Who was Ernie Goodman?
Well, Ernie Goodman was a man who stood at the forefront of some of the most dramatic struggles for social justice over the last century. And so the story of Ernie is really the story not only of Detroit, but the story of those long campaigns for civil rights, for labor rights, and a whole range of issues, starting from the 1930s when he became a labor lawyer and was actively involved in the rise of the UAW and the sit-down strikes and that whole dramatic story. And from there, in the 1940s, was very prominent as a civil rights lawyer in the early years of the civil rights movement, when the labor movement and the civil rights movement were really growing out of the same roots here in this city. And from there to the Red Scare of the 1950s, when only a few were willing to stand up for the issues of the Bill of Rights and First Amendment rights and the right to dissent from a domineering majority. And he went through the House Un-American Activities Committee, the Smith Act trials, and that prolonged sort of winter time in his career when he was isolated and one of the few stalwarts who stood up for the Bill of Rights and was vindicated towards the end of that decade, and then was able to, in effect, reinvent himself as a participant in the New Left and the civil rights movement of the early 1960s, the anti-war movement, opposing the war in Vietnam, and then the Black Power movement. He became prominent. His last major case was in the mid-1970s when he defended the Attica prison rebels. So it is an amazing story, and what I really loved about writing this book and working on it was that as an historian, you sometimes become really accustomed to these sort of vertical chimneys of category, so that you either study the civil rights movement, or you study economic history, or you study foreign policy, or you study the labor. And what was great about writing a biography was that you actually, through the lived experience of the protagonist in this case, you see how these are actually all connected and often simultaneous and at least successive events, so that it's a larger story seen through the eyes of this one unique individual who was not just a lawyer but also an organizer, really.
Ernie Goodman is who we're talking about. The book is The Color of Law and aptly published by the Wayne State University Press, part of its Great Lakes Books series. And you can go to ErnieGoodman.com. A lot of events around the book are there. And also my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, will have a link as well. Steve Bampson, let's go right to Ernie Goodman's birth. He lived quite a long life, into his 90s. He was born in what year?
He was born in 1906, and we often played with the idea of calling the book 20th Century Man, because he lived in every decade of the 20th century. And so it's a remarkable trajectory in terms of what's happening to Detroit in those years. The dramatic rise and fall of this city is one he experienced as a teenager and a young lawyer in the 1920s, when he, by the way, wasn't particularly inclined towards radical politics at all. He was he aspired to be a corporate lawyer, but found that a hard go, in part because of the anti-Semitism that was so dominant at that time, and which severely restricted the professional reach for lawyers and doctors and whatnot of Jewish heritage. And then, obviously, difficulties in 1929 and the years following, when it was very difficult for any lawyer to make their way and find business opportunities. And he finally had the kind of conversion crisis that millions of people had during the Great Depression, when all of the promises of upward mobility and reward for, you know, striving and hard work turned out to be empty promises that meant nothing unemployment.
Those days are behind us.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the other interesting dimension of this, is just noting the many, many moments in Ernie's life that resonate with the issues that are still with us today, whether it's immigrant history, whether it's the history of the national security state, whether it's labor rights and civil rights. All of those issues are still with us, different in some of the details, but still fundamentally these are the kinds of issues that people are still trying to come to grips with.
And Ernie Goodman, Detroit lawyer and involved in all of the major struggles for civil rights, civil liberties, labor during the 20th century, and born in Detroit in 1906 into this Jewish section of Detroit, which then was Hastings Street, which produced any number of very prominent people, quite a few lawyers, quite a few radicals.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's a dimension of Detroit history that, of course, has been literally paved over. It's where I-375 and I-75 are. And the portion of Hastings Street that was just north of Gratiot, on either side of Gratiot, really, straddling Gratiot, was the Jewish ghetto. And very difficult to find accommodations, housing outside of that area. There were prevailing restrictions on, basically in the real estate industry, on who would sell homes to a Jewish family. But over time, that community slowly migrated sort of north and west, eventually arriving at 12th Street, and then continuing north and west into Southfield. And so part of the story is the story of Ernie's, in effect, learning what it felt like to suffer a thoroughgoing discrimination. And it accounts a lot for his later ability to empathize with and identify with the struggle for black civil rights.
Steve Babson, in The Color of Law that you wrote with Dave Riddle and David Alsala about Ernie Goodman, Detroit, and the struggle for labor and civil rights, as you say, he's a prism through which you can see so many of the events of Detroit history and actually U.S. history as well. We're fortunate to have someone like him because so many of these stories, I was thinking about the unemployed council of 1931 and how there's nothing like that now. People mostly experience unemployment as great personal sadness and tragedy and try to get out of it all by themselves. But tell us a little about 1931, what Detroit was like, and the role that Ernie Goodman played.
Well, at that point, this was 31 would be before actually Ernie had his conversion to socialism, to the labor movement, to the civil rights movement. In 1931, he was still a striving wannabe corporate lawyer who was finding it very difficult to make his way, particularly in a city where the unemployment rate is only estimated because the government did not make an effort to collect unemployment statistics at that time. But the estimates are that in Detroit, roughly 45% to 55% of the population was unemployed. And the city hospital reported at least 4 to 5 cadavers that were brought to their doorstep every morning. People who had been found dead in the streets, dying of exposure. And a city which in that regard certainly evokes what we understand about what's going on today in the city of Detroit, but in a different circumstance because it was a very wealthy city until 1929, and people are surrounded by the most advanced production technology on the planet, and yet it's largely the factories are empty. And so there was an acute sense of the injustice of this, that here was the way to produce wealth, and yet it was lying fallow. As capitalism basically had proven to be a complete failure at that moment. And that's what spurred Ernie and many others to eventually change their identification with the social and become aligned with a social movement that would seek a transformation of that economy.
Tell us just briefly about the unemployed march to the gates of the Ford Rouge plant and the results of that.
It was 1932, and the unemployed councils, which had begun organizing several years beforehand, largely organized by members of the Communist Party or the Socialist Party. There was at this time, remember, no unemployment insurance, no welfare safety net, no Social Security, no nothing. When you were unemployed, you were basically pitched out into the street and would have to fend for yourself. And the only way people felt that they could do so would be by coming together in these neighborhood organizations called the unemployed councils, often led, as I said, by communists, but overwhelmingly made up of workers, whether they were Republicans, Democrats, apolitical, what have you, because they were desperate. And in 1932, they marched on the Ford plant in response to Henry Ford's somewhat delirious claim that there really was no crisis to speak of, that people could find work if they simply hitched up their belt and made the effort. Obviously, this was a real misrepresentation of what was going on because, after all, his own factory had largely been shut down. He had laid off three-quarters of his workforce. So they marched on the Ford plant in Dearborn, about 3,000, asking Ford for jobs, basically. They were going to call his bluff. If he was insisting there was work available, they were going to march to Detroit, to Dearborn and take him up on his offer and demand also that he support some of the foods kitchens and soup lines that were supporting the unemployed. And instead they were met by gunfire. Four were killed immediately. A fifth man died of his wounds later. And the four of them, are buried in Woodmere Cemetery. Local 600, many years later, actually commemorated their memory by placing gravestones in what were otherwise unmarked graves. But it was, in effect, the start of a recognition of just how severe the crisis was and the social forces that were now at loggerheads over which way to go.
Now, how would Ernie Goodman, for instance, get information about this that he would be sympathetic to? Certainly the big papers, the Detroit Times, the Detroit News, the Detroit Free Press, all characterized this as a communist riot to which the Dearborn police responded. What was it that Ernie Goodman, the attorney and the subject of the book, The Color of Law, where did he get his information, I guess, because that's what people always ask today. Where do we find out stuff? I mean, we got the internet today, not true then.
Right, and it's an excellent question, because it also brings to mind the fact that the newspapers varied in their coverage. The initial reporting, as you say, was a hysterical exaggeration of a communist threat and basically blaming the victims. Many of whom, by the way, there were roughly 50 wounded, and many of them were handcuffed to their beds in the hospital. But some of the reporters, particularly the Detroit Times, the old Hearst paper, actually did a much better job at subsequently following up and reporting on the actual circumstances of that march, in which the police just opened fire on an unarmed crowd. And by the way, also Ford guards firing through the gates on Miller Road there. And in addition to that, Ernie just happened to be working downtown. He had an office, and there was a newsstand on Griswold downtown that sold copies of the New Masses. And Ernie started picking it up, like a lot of people, curious to see if there was some way of comprehending what was going on. So he started reading.
Yeah, the communist paper.
Right.
Yeah.
The New Masses was published by the Communist Party. And as he recalled it years later, he didn't always agree with what he was reading, but increasingly he found it much more persuasive than the denial that was so frequently the menu offered by the established press.
Well, we are talking about the book, The Color of Law, Ernie Goodman, Detroit and the Struggle for Labor and Civil Rights. Steve Babson is my guest, and he's written the book along with Dave Riddle and David Elsala. And I can see we have now about 10 minutes left, and we haven't even gotten Ernie Goodman into action. And that's why there is a 500-page book. The book is extraordinary. Steve Babson, let me leave it to you. Where do you want to go? How can we tell people about Ernie Goodman exemplifies the man and his work?
Well, let me jump ahead a couple decades. I'll just say in passing that he met a guy named Maurice Sugar, a lawyer who was very much a man of the left, and it was his mentoring that brought Ernie into a new approach to lawyering and an identification with the people and an aspiration to serve them. He became actually worked with Maurice Sugar as an associate general counsel to the UAW for many years. But then with the onset of the Red Scare, there was a falling out, and Ernie was banished, along with others of his political inclination, that is, they were left-wingers, to the margins of society, in effect. And the National Lawyers Guild, the organization that was formed to support and promote the ideas of a progressive legal practice, itself went into decline. It was attacked as a subversive organization. Its membership went from 5,000 to less than 500. And many lawyers found, no matter how much they might have personally identified with progressive politics and the need for fundamental social change, it just was a killing matter to be associated with the guild and associated with the left. Ernie was one of those who kept struggling and fighting to defend those principles.
This is the late 1940s and into the 1950s.
By the late 1950s, it is the Lawyers Guild, led by Ernie Goodman, who had weathered this storm of the Red Scare and the repeated rounds of prosecutions and persecutions, to identify the next big struggle in American history, and that was, of course, the emerging civil rights movement. And keep in mind that at that time, the American Bar Association was a whites-only organization dominated by corporate lawyers who denounced the early civil rights movement, as many did, as a communist plot, because after all, it was calling for affirmative action and it was calling for civil rights for blacks. And this was regarded by many in a society that was still basically wedded to the ideas of white supremacy. This was regarded as subversive. And Ernie, in contrast to the American Bar Association, devoted the remaining resources of the guild and basically regarded this as this was the only way the guild could possibly survive and have a role in the future, was to identify with that early civil rights movement. So many of you, many of your listeners, I should say, may be aware of an event called Freedom Summer in 1964, which was one of the decisive battles in Mississippi over voting rights. And at the end of that summer of struggle with young students going south to support the effort of African Americans to register to vote, to, in other words, assert a right that was guaranteed under the Bill of Rights but denied under the Jim Crow laws of Mississippi and elsewhere. At the end of that summer, five were dead and many hundreds arrested, 900 arrests, in fact, and no one to defend them in the South except for the National Lawyers Guild. Ernie led the Lawyers Guild into a prolonged campaign to support that civil rights struggle in the South. At the same time, by the way, he was also active in the civil rights struggle in the North, and saw it as important to recognize that it wasn't just a regional issue. This was a national issue and a need for national legislation and a national movement. And it was the guild, led by Goodman, who shamed the American Bar Association into finally, after several years, coming around to the defense of people who, after all, were defending their rights under the Constitution.
Steve Babson, you and I sort of blithely talk about the Communist Party and what have you, and probably to people under 50, it doesn't raise many signals. Certainly people over that remember or have some memories of when the communists were our enemies and the communists working in this country were subversives and tools of Moscow and what have you. How in your book or do you treat this? I mean, that communism now seems like, certainly, well, in the way it is, yesterday's newspaper, but then it was pretty lively. How did Ernie Goodman, was he a slave of Moscow?
Well, he was accused of being so because he defended communists when they were falsely accused of being subversives and devoted to force and violence. But it's a complicated story because the Communist Party was a very mixed bag in this period. The Communist Party made many mistakes in terms of their identification with the Soviet Union and their defense of Joseph Stalin, when in fact Stalin and the Soviet Union were devoted to a very totalitarian and nasty internal politics that crushed all dissent. But in the United States, the Communist Party, at the same time, most of its members were devoted to an idea, the ideals of equality before the law and rights for workers and support for unionization and a decent wage and opposition to the sort of corporate violence that greeted many people when they tried to organize unions. And so Ernie identified with them. His closest links, really, with the members of the Communist Party were with the people at the grassroots, particularly, for example, at Local 600, the UAW Ford local in Dearborn, a local which at its peak had roughly 80,000 members working in that massive complex in Dearborn. And those were the people Ernie identified and worked with, not the national leaders who very often did fall in to sort of lockstep with Soviet policy.
Let's, boy, time is a-flying, and that's why the book, The Color of Law, Ernie Goodman, Detroit and the Struggle for Labor and Civil Rights, is 500 pages. We're just skimming the surface here and moving along the decades pretty quickly. Ernie Goodman's last case, as you said, big case, as you said, Steve Babson, was revolved around the Attica Revolt and his defense of a man named Shango. Can you tell us briefly about that?
Well, the Attica Rebellion in 1971 was a remarkable event in its own right. This was at the time a moment where there were more Americans killing Americans in any single event than since the Civil War. And it was a rebellion at Attica Prison in northern New York over the terrible conditions that prevailed in that prison, the abuse of the prisoner population. These, after all, were prisoners who had been, in many cases, convicted of violent crimes, and yet they still, I think, had a genuine claim to humane treatment, and their rebellion insisted on their being treated as men, and Shango was one of the key leaders of that rebellion. which ended with a massacre conducted by the National Guard and the New York State Police and some of the prison guards who were armed with scattershot shotguns and blasted their way back into the prison after the prisoners had held a portion of that prison for 4 days demanding improvements in their living conditions. And 39 people were killed. 10 of them were the hostages that the prisoners had held, but they were actually shot by the police who were fighting their way into the prison. And Ernie came to the defense of Shango, who was one of the key leaders of that rebellion, and exposed the extraordinary web of coerced testimony that the prison officials and state officials had coerced out of prisoners, the false testimony and false claims that initially indicated Shango was simply a murderer. And it was Ernie's work, along with many other lawyers, I should say, many of them members of the National Lawyers Guild, many from Detroit, who helped on the case. Over several years of litigation, finally exposed the state's coercive tactics and misrepresentation of what had happened, and won acquittal for Shango.
You, at the beginning of our conversation about your book that you co-authored, The Color of Law, sort of summed up Ernie Goodman's life. I mean, looking back, as we have about another minute or so, and from time to time during our discussion, you talked about that this isn't just history. It's not just, quote, interesting, although it's extraordinarily interesting. What would you hope for in terms of this book, the impact it would have on, like law students, for instance, or just the general reading population?
Well, I would hope that it would persuade people that the sometimes demoralizing circumstances of the present, in which the future looks pretty bleak when you're thinking about prospects for work and for social justice. And what Ernie's life tells us is that the only way in which we can make our way forward as a nation and as a society is when each one of us makes that commitment to principle and does what they can, puts their shoulder to the wheel, or in effect puts their shoulder to the pendulum, because as many people understand it, there is a pendulum to the politics of this country, and it moves from progressive change, sometimes to reaction. That pendulum doesn't move back and forth, however, without people actually putting their shoulder to it and giving it everything they can in the way of a commitment to social justice.
Well, Steve Babson, thank you so much for coming in. Steve Babson, along with Dave Riddle and David Elsela, has written The Color of Law, Ernie Goodman, Detroit, and the Struggle for Labor and Civil Rights. It's an extraordinary book. It's published by the Great Lakes Book Series from Wayne State University Press. You can go to erniegoodman.com, and there's lots of events around this book coming up. You might want to check that out. And there'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Steve Babson, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Join Scott Randall this Thursday from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. at O'Reilly Auto Parts on DeQuinder Road in Madison Heights. Check out great savings throughout the store and register to win tickets to an upcoming Tigers game.
Don't just dream about a brighter future. Go for it. If you want to pursue a career involving technology, look to a leader in technology education, ITT Technical Institute. ITT Tech offers career-focused programs in electronics technology, information technology, and drafting and design. Call 800-741-5123. You can develop knowledge and skills that you can use to pursue opportunities in a variety of career fields. ITT Tech's programs are designed to give you practical, real-world experience. Classes and day or evening courses meet just a few days each week. Career services are available for students and graduates, and financial aid is available for those who qualify. Would a career involving technology make your dreams come true? Call ITT Tech right now for more information. Call 800-741-5123. 800-741-5123. That's 800-741-5123. Homeowners, the mortgage market is starting to move, but the good news is rates are still incredibly low. Don't miss this opportunity to refinance your mortgage. Call Quicken Loans at 888-249-1425. Quicken Loans is America's home loan experts, closing 1 million home loans over 25 years. And recently, J.D. Power & Associates ranked Quicken Loans highest in customer satisfaction in primary mortgage origination. Find out how quick and easy it is to refinance with Quicken Loans. Call right now for a free rate quote and see how much Quicken Loans can lower your monthly payment. Call 888-249-1425. That's 888-249-1425. For J.D. Power & Associates award information, visit jdpower.com. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. Nationwide mortgage licensing system number 3030. That's Quicken Loans. 888-249-1425. 888-249-1425.
Does your tap water have an unpleasant odor and taste? Are water deposits staining your sinks and laundry? Did you know that lime scale may be ruining your pipes and appliances? And that chlorine in your water can actually be harmful to your health? Your water shouldn't be a hazard. Improve the water in your entire home with a HydroCare Dual Action System. This compact system eliminates lime scale and purifies water with the most advanced technologies. It uses no salts or chemicals, and there's no loss of water pressure. Now you'll enjoy clean, healthy water, and your appliances will be protected from costly lime scale damage. Satisfaction guarantee. Get free information on the HydroCare water system. It's one of the quality air and water products from Wave Home Solutions. Go to HelloFreshWater.com. That's HelloFreshWater.com. Or call now 1-877-965-8866. That's 1-877-965-8866.
Now's the time.
Now's the time to make a difference.
Now's the time to do what's right.
To help a family.
Now's the time to volunteer.
To make a commitment.
To make new friends.
To make dreams come true.
To help a child.
Now's the time to help Habitat for Humanity build hope and change lives with a family in your community or around the world.
Now's the time.
Now, more than ever, help build it.
Visit Habitat.org.
Friday, May 20th at the Fillmore Detroit for the 2011 Grip Rock Girl Finals Bash featuring Stone Sour. Plus, Art of Dying. Vote for your favorite Rip Rock Girl contestants right now at WRIF.com. Then see the four final contestants on stage at the Fillmore as the next Rip Rock Girl is chosen. Tickets on sale now at all Ticketmaster outlets and online at LiveNation.com. Brought to you by Bud Light. It's the sure sign of a good time. Here we go. MetroMix.com and 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
How old's the roof on your home? If it's over 15 years old, how much longer will it last before the leaks begin? Think about the damage. Then think about this. If it's time for a new roof, call Sears to get your roofing done right. And if you call Sears right now, you'll save $500. Just call 1-877-938-1414. Sears licensed fully insured contractors install a variety of shingles and styles that are built for long-lasting performance. And you'll save $500 if you call now. So call Sears for a free in-home consultation. 1-877-938-1414. Hurry. Offer ends soon. Not available in all states. Installation provided by Sears authorized licensed contractors. License information available upon request. So if you need a new roof, call Sears Roofing. Call right now and save $500. Call 1-877-938-1414. That's 1-877-938-1414. Sears.
Are you ready to do something about your high credit card debt? Tired of paying double-digit interest rates, late fees, over-limit fees? It's time to stop the madness. Get out of debt the safe and affordable way with Credit Card Relief. With Credit Card Relief, there are no upfront fees, no monthly maintenance fees, and no settlement fees. You don't pay anything until a debt is settled, all with a 90-day money-back guarantee. That's Credit Card Relief. Managed by local attorneys in-state, with workout plans tailored to your debt situation. Get out of debt in months instead of years, all while saving thousands in future bank fees. Call the original Credit Card Relief, where the consultation is free and the results are real.
Call 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282.
I guess we got caught up in the crazy housing boom.
We had been in the house so long, we didn't want to lose it.
What these people share is that they all got in trouble with their mortgages, and they all called a certified housing counselor for help.
Our housing counselor looked at our paperwork, and she knew something was wrong.
She understood what needed to be done, and she helped me work it out with the bank.
This is a free service. Call the National Foundation for Credit Counseling now. Call 1-866-687-6322 or visit mortgagehelpnow.org.
Is it time for a new roof? Call Sears Roofing. You can save $500 if you call right now. Just call 1-877-938-1414. Hurry, offer ends soon. Not available in all states. Installation provided by Sears Authorized Licensed Contractors. License information available upon request. Get your roofing job done right. Call Sears Roofing now. You can save $500. Call now. 1-877-938-1414. Sears.
If you have a job instead of a career, will you be satisfied tomorrow? But if you develop knowledge and skills, who knows how far you can go? If you're interested in electronics technology, drafting and design, or information technology, call ITT Technical Institute. Classes meet just a few times a week, and financial aid is available to those who qualify. Call ITT Tech now for more information. 800-741-5123. 800-741-5123.
Listen up, ladies. Right now, Bare Minerals by Bare Essentials is inviting you to participate in a special nationwide giveaway of the mineral makeup everyone's talking about. That's right. We're letting everyone who calls try America's number one mineral makeup risk-free. Just call 1-800-506-8947 to find out how. This is an exclusive radio-only offer you don't want to miss. You've probably heard about Bare Minerals Foundation. It was quoted in Glamour Magazine as a magic eraser. Allure Magazine, In Style, and Elle Magazine, and Leaders in Beauty continue to rave about how Bare Minerals Foundation is naturally radiant and good for your skin. Now you can participate in our nationwide giveaway and see for yourself. Bare Minerals, makeup so pure you can sleep in it. Experience the foundation that started the makeup revolution. Participate in this special opportunity to try Bare Minerals Foundation risk-free. We will also send you a free gift set. Just call 1-800-506-8947 now. Hurry, you don't want to miss this exclusive radio offer. 1-800-506-8947.
More rock now on The Riff.
Thank you.
WRIF HD1 Detroit.
And nah, nah, lay off Detroit. Them people is living in Mad Max times.
Everything rocks.
Wow.